You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio, Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly, during each of 20 trips to Afghanistan as an invited guest of the Afghan Peace Volunteers, has lived alongside ordinary Afghan people in a working-class neighborhood in Kabul. I joined her on one of those trips. In June 2016, Kathy participated in a delegation that visited five cities in Russia, aiming to learn about Russian opinions regarding NATO exercises taking place on their borders. Kelly has joined with activists in various regions of the U.S. to protest drone warfare by holding demonstrations outside of U.S. bases in Nevada, California, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. In 2015, for carrying a loaf of bread and a letter across a line at Whiteman Air Force Base, she served 3 months in prison. Kathy Kelly will be speaking this week at the Democracy Convention in Minneapolis, including at the Peace and Democracy Conference organized by World Beyond War, and will be speaking in September at the No War 2017 War and the Environment Conference in Washington, D.C. See worldbeyondwar.org. Kathy, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David. Thanks for the invitation to be on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, you are one of my favorite peace activists, and I think people should hear as much from you as possible. There are so many threats now, Kathy, to peace and to the environment. It's hard to know where to start. What do you make of the latest round of sanctions against Russia, North Korea, and Iran?
Well, you know, I think the United States foreign policy has been so squarely based on threat and force, and this has led to wars, to killing, to bloodshed, to torture, and to the United States becoming less secure in the world because there's so many people that feel deep grievance and antagonism because they've been subjected to brutalities caused by U.S. foreign policy. And what would be the alternative? Diplomacy, negotiation, and educating the U.S. public to better understand the world around us instead of demonizing world leaders and, you know, kind of having a cartoon version of foreign policy, the good guys and the bad guys. So, you know, in my own personal history, going over to Iraq and on 27 different occasions, seeing children wasted, tortured, shriveled up and dying in their hospital beds while their mothers looked at us with puzzled horror, you know, why is anybody punishing my child like this? It seems to me that the very word sanctions connotes for me a kind of blood-curdling fear, having seen what the result of the economic sanctions against Iraq was. Now, in the current situation, the Trump administration's anger over having to waive sanctions against Iran, because Iran is complying with the International Atomic Energy Association inspections and has complied with the many, you know, very costly measures that it had to take in order to have the pact that was arranged through a great deal of dogged diplomacy go into place. I think Iran is an example of a country that's in a kind of a prime position for the United States to prefer diplomacy rather than threat and force. But here is the Trump administration saying, well, we're going to find some way to go after Iran and satisfy a base that is sort of hungry for war against some kind of an enemy, it would seem. The same thing with regard to North Korea. There's just simply no point in saying that we're going to insist on denuclearization. It's not going to happen, and it makes so much more sense for the United States to instead emphasize negotiation and diplomacy. I mean, the people I see who are really embracing that are non-governmental representatives like Anne Wright and Medea Benjamin, who've gone back and forth, or Christine Ahn, or even Jill Stein, trying to see if there's some way to promote person-to-person diplomacy rather than continually foment the idea that the United States can punish people using our weapons if they don't subordinate themselves to what are considered to be U.S. national interests.
Indeed, I just watched Jill Stein on MSNBC on this topic, and she made the case for peace and diplomacy. I doubt they will ever have her on again. But it seems like attacking Iran will simply reinforce the desire of North Korea and Russia and countries around the world to acquire and build nuclear weapons, because Iran is the targeted nation that doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Well, and, you know, I think when we attacked Iraq, that certainly was the message. If you don't have nuclear weapons, you better try really hard to get some, because this is what the United States will do to a country that it knows doesn't have any capacity to fight back. And you know, apparently within the Oval Office, Trump sort of had a temper tantrum and said, "What do you mean I can't attack Iran?" And Tillerson and General Mattis had to kind of calm him down and say, "Look, you know, we know you'd like to just attack them right away, but you know, you can't do that because they're complying with the accord as it was arranged. There's no evidence of noncompliance, but maybe we can work out something, like we can stage a demand for the IAEA weapons inspectors to go someplace, and we know the Iranians are going to balk at that, and then we can kind of say, look, they're not complying." And you know, having watched that process unfold in Iraq on top of the economic sanctions, and then the setup that was arranged so that the United States would have some kind of an excuse to invade, they simply didn't want to turn back that invasion plan, no matter what the facts on the ground were. And so I think it's very, very important for the peace movement, the anti-war movement, educators, and in the environmental movement as well, to come together and make sure that people are confident in their ability to speak out and say these wars are completely unjustified. They make no sense. We won't tolerate them. And you know, I also believe we should be saying the same with regard to United States support for the Saudis, who've maintained an extremely punitive naval blockade of Yemen, are contributing to the exacerbation of cholera and the horrible starvation and near famine conditions, not only through their airstrikes, but by preventing fuel from getting in and by having decimated the civilian infrastructure needed in order to cope with starvation and disease.
There's so many outrages. I want to come back to Iran and to North Korea and to Russia, but on Yemen for the moment, it's just shocking to me, Kathy Kelly, that this enormous famine and epidemics of disease are not more of a humanitarian concern in the United States and in the Western world. And I wonder if that's because they are caused by U.S. supported warfare, or what the reason is for the lack of caring.
Well, you know, the stories are so horrible in terms of what people are facing right now, not only in Yemen, but also in at least three countries, sometimes referred to as in the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Sudan, Nigeria. It should be on the front page every single day that as many as 20 million people could die of starvation, that the Saudis have continued to pummel Yemen, and that the United States is supporting them, even though there's been no declaration of war on the part of the United States against the Houthi rebels. It would be very, very difficult to establish the idea that U.S. security, the security of people inside the United States, is at risk because of Houthi rebels. Most people would say, well, who are the Houthi rebels? Where are they? What's the problem? And yet the United States is supporting the Saudis. They could not continue their war if it were not for United States support in jet refueling. Those Saudi jets go over Yemen. They bomb targets. They've repeatedly bombed civilian targets, destroyed four Doctors Without Borders hospitals, have bombed public gatherings, including funerals, transportation, including buses, have bombed mosques, the sewage and sanitation facilities. Roadways have been bombed so badly that the United Nations can't even get vaccines against cholera into the country because it's so impossible to circulate them. So they said, well, we better just take all these vaccines that we wanted to bring to Yemen, where 400,000 people have been identified as suffering from cholera. We better take them someplace else because we can't distribute them because of what the Saudis have done inside of Yemen. And yet, you know, at what point does this war ever become discussed on the floor of the U.S. Congress? There have been, I mean, really Herculean efforts, I think, on the part of people like the Just Foreign Policy or Within Peace Action to try to force a vote on the floor of Congress, a congressional vote, with regard to whether or not the United States is authorized to be a co-belligerent, basically, in the Saudi war against Yemen. But it's very, very difficult to do that. And that's why I think one thing we can all be doing this summer at gatherings like the one coming up in Minneapolis or in preparation for September with World Beyond War, we can all be encouraging people to make it known to their elected representatives, look, I care about this, and I want to know what you're going to do about the United States' continued support for the Saudis in making war against Yemen.
If Kathy Kelly, if there continues to be this build-up toward a war on Iran with these sort of pre-advertised deceptions and manipulations, despite having blocked these attempts year after year, despite them not overthrowing Syria first, as I understand was the plan for years, what should activists do and what will you do? Will it make sense to take people to Iran as you went to Iraq to be there as human shields, witnesses, voices against the shock and awe campaign? How could we get many, many and prominent people to go to Iran?
Well, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure that the Iranians are so trusting of people from the United States that they'll open their doors and issue visas. But, you know, I have to say, I myself thought I was kind of keeping on top of news about the compliance, the Iranian compliance with the pact that had been set up. But when I read an article in the New York Review of Books by Jessica Matthews, and she, reviewing a book by Trita Parsi, lists all of the ways in which the Iranians have already complied. I mean, if the United States could get the North Koreans to do even a fraction of what the Iranians have already done, they'd consider it to be a wild success. So I think one thing we can do is education, help people understand that the Iranians have already dismantled of their centrifuges. They had 19,000. They've got it down to 6,000 now in terms of their capacity to produce fuel for a nuclear weapon. They've already poured concrete into their plutonium reactors so that it's completely unusable. They've answered every question that the International Atomic Energy Association asked them about weapons that they might have had in the past. They've 24/7 made every single place that the IAEA wanted, you know, to have available access to, made them open and available for inspectors to go. They're creating no blockage, no troubles. The IAEA has signed off saying, yes, we've had complete compliance. And so why not continue to emphasize dogged diplomacy and negotiation? Instead, it seems like the United States, once again, is agitating to get a war going. You have to wonder, is it because they've got so many weapons stockpiled they don't know where to use them? Iran is three times the size of Iraq, and thankfully it hasn't been pummeled by the most comprehensive economic sanctions ever imposed in modern history, as were imposed on Iraq. I mean, the Iranians have quite a sophisticated infrastructure, and I think for the United States to anticipate that it somehow could just go in and invade and take over is highly unrealistic. And the other thing that we should remember is 2 days after the United States said, okay, we recognize that Iran is in compliance with the accord that had been worked out, Rouhani, who's a moderate, won a landslide majority in elections. And so you've got people within Iran who understand that by pursuing a moderate leadership rather than the hardline leadership, they have a better chance to become less isolated and to interact with people in the world. And that's as it should be. I mean, anytime, and this goes for North Korea as well, anytime you want to enable a group of people to have a better chance at getting out from under autocratic authoritarian governance, strengthen the education within the country, strengthen the country's capacity to communicate with people outside the country, and strengthen social services within the country. But the United States tends to do just the opposite, eliminate people's social services for delivering humanitarian goods within North Korea, isolate the country as completely as possible, and lessen the education within the country.
It seems like there's not really a public uprising in the United States demanding a war on Iran. It seems like Donald Trump campaigned on, I'm against all these government overthrows and wars and occupations, and it certainly didn't cost him votes. Yet the moment that Donald Trump says Iran must be fought, there are guaranteed to be millions of Americans who will obediently say, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, so how do we counter that? Clearly education is not enough. Clearly the success that that you see in Iran and could happen in North Korea is understood as a failure for weapons dealers who must be driving this, because the public is not. How do we get the public to resist? It's something that has happened, but it's on other occasions it hasn't, and the public has flipped and gone along with the propaganda. How do we prepare people?
Well, it is really difficult, because it's not only preparing people; it's getting people to care. Getting people to care about what happened to Iraq following our sanctions and our invasion, getting people to recognize some responsibility on the part of the United States for the chaos and the constant, tortuous bereavement Iraqis experience, not only in Mosul, but in Baghdad still, and in other parts of Iraq where the civil war really still continues. So getting people to care about what the consequences of U.S. wars and invasions are, and how countries don't recover very quickly from that, and how it gives rise to armed jihadist groups that then could want to exact revenge against people in the United States. And so it doesn't really increase our security here. In fact, it jeopardizes the security. I don't think that there would have been a creation of ISIS or Daesh had the United States not invaded Iraq. So, I think for those who would remember back that far, in 2003, the United States came very, very close. The United States peace movement, the international peace movement, to stopping that war before it started. And I think that another thing we should emphasize is that public opinion and galvanizing resistance can come very, very close to stopping the warlords. And you've certainly done a lot of that, David, through showing how the organized resistance to U.S. intervention into World War I actually led to a document that said we're going to outlaw war because that war was just as bad as we expected it would be. But anticipating that internationally, worldwide groups can't excuse themselves from trying, even when we feel impotent.
Yeah.
I'll just say that again. Even when we think we are impotent, we can't turn this around, that doesn't excuse us from trying, because we bear so much responsibility for buildup of weapons and use of weapons and then the terrible bloodletting and destruction that happens after those weapons are used.
I agree entirely, Kathy, and I think we did play a role in stopping a bombing of Syria 4 years ago, and repeatedly in stopping an invasion of Iran, including putting through this agreement, because there have been parties that have wanted to attack Iran in Washington, D.C. for years and years now. And I think it may help us to point out to the public that we've been told Iran must urgently be attacked or we'll all die each of these times, right? And Iran hasn't been attacked and we haven't all died. And so we can maybe keep continuing that for decades. But I wanted to ask you, because you've been gracious enough to agree to come speak at this conference we're planning at World Beyond War, on how peace and environmental groups can work better together and accomplish more together, and what the two issues have to do with each other. These wars aren't exactly good for the natural environment, are they?
Well, certainly every time that I've gone over to Afghanistan, or Brian Sherrill has gone back and forth, our friend Sherry Morin is there now, we can see how the creation of the network of bases within Afghanistan has had a very, very detrimental effect on the consumption of water, on the distribution of water, on the distribution of horrible leftover ordnance that has yet to be cleaned up, and we're not sure it's ever going to be cleaned up after the last big surge departed from Afghanistan. And then the more that the United States emphasizes war as the solution and more militarism as the solution, the less resources people have to cope with the terrible environmental problems they already have, sometimes caused by drought, sometimes caused by natural disasters, but very much caused by the ways in which people haven't been able to fix up sewage and sanitation systems, for instance, in Kabul, where, it's got the highest concentration of fecal matter in the air of almost any place in the world. And truthfully, when people come back from Kabul, they're sick for weeks because of the high toll that Kabul air takes on somebody's respiratory system. You realize, even just brushing your teeth, my saliva is black. So this is what people live with day in and day out in areas where the United States has said, well, we don't really care about those kinds of problems. We care about maintaining our military bases and using your land as a pivot place for us to threaten China or Russia, or maybe someday take your mineral resource wealth if we decide that that's worth our time.
Do people that you talk with around the United States realize that the war in Afghanistan is rolling on, and that the Pentagon is working on another, plan to win it over the coming many years and decades? That this is something that still has to be ended, and that Congressman Walter Jones has a bill to cut off the money and end it, but it's not going anywhere?
Well, truthfully, I think that it's a war that has been forgotten before it ended. I think most people have so little contact with soldiers that are going over to Afghanistan, because quite honestly, there aren't that many. There are many more security contractors headed over to Afghanistan. There's plenty of reporting done by the SIGAR group, the Special Inspector General on Afghan Reconstruction, that lays out in minute detail the environmental consequences of U.S. militarism, the abuses that have happened because of money that's gone to fund ghost hospitals and ghost schools and ghost military bases and the corruption that's been fed. And all of that information is there, but I don't know that the Congress people read those reports. Every now and then you'll see a strong piece of reporting done by a major newspaper like the New York Times. But in general, I think people have just kind of forgotten about Afghanistan. And it's so impressive to me that our young Afghan peace volunteer friends, they don't wait for the U.S. government or the Afghan government to try to help solve problems. They figure out ways. I mean, they're pretty remarkable and resilient in figuring out ways that they can themselves help one another make it through these desperate times.
Afghanistan does, we have just a couple minutes left, Kathy. Afghanistan does occasionally pop up in the news in an accusation against Russia, which is, you know, generally what most of the news is these days, accusations against Russia. And the accusation is that Russia is arming the Taliban. Is that true?
Well, you know, that seems to be a particularly galling accusation because, I mean, a guy named C.J. Chivers had done research about 2 years ago showing how many millions of United States armaments that were shipped over either to U.S. soldiers or were directly given to the Afghan National Army ended up on the black market or have been stolen by the Taliban. And so, you know, when we think about how the Taliban has acquired top-notch weaponry, well, it's got United States serial numbers on it.
Yeah.
And so...
But not Russian, as far as you know.
No. I mean, the Taliban in some ways have reason to want to continue keeping a United States presence inside of Afghanistan because that's how they can raise money. I mean, the United States pays them off not to attack their convoys. And then they can always, you know, make an attack on an Afghan base that's been supplied by U.S. weapons. And, quite often the people at the base have to give up and run. And then they just go in and they scoop up the weapons. And that makes them all the more able to intimidate and overtake small towns as they have increasingly expanded their control of roadways and of access to larger cities.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with all the money that the United States has spent in trying to win a war in Afghanistan, in fact, they haven't been able to stop the encroachment of the Taliban.
Well, it sounds
60% of the country.
It sounds like it's a win-win for the military in the United States and for the Taliban and everybody except all the people being killed and injured and poisoned and troops coming home and killing themselves. Kathy Kelly is with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. I think the website is vcnv.org. You can see her at the Democracy Convention, democracyconvention.org, and at the conference coming up in September, worldbeyondwar.org. Kathy Kelly, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for this time, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the U.S. locks up more people than any other country. In a criminal justice system whose racial and class biases are demonstrated and whose entrenchment in the economy is problematic. As prison unrest sparks around the country, highlighting conditions that shock the senses, many would like to reopen a conversation about the purposes of incarceration for individuals and for society. But it's difficult to have an informed conversation when a key ingredient, public knowledge of what happens inside prisons and jails, is missing. Prisons are shielded from public view on purpose, of course, and journalists have to work hard for access when it's possible at all. The result is a media landscape that pairs relative silence about prison life with an absurdly outsized focus on crime, certain kinds of crime. It hardly encourages compassion for those who wind up behind bars or even an accurate understanding of who they are. The question of access to the country's prisons is the subject of a recent article on TheConversation.com by Heather Ann Thompson. Thompson teaches at the University of Michigan in the Afro-American and African Studies and History Departments and the Residential College. She wrote the book Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City, and more recently, Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy, winner of the Pulitzer Prize in History for this year. We spoke with Heather Ann Thompson about what's hidden behind the walls of America's prisons this week on Counterspin. That's coming up, but first, a little history. American planes hit North Vietnam after second attack on our destroyers. Move taken to halt new aggression. That was the Washington Post headline some 53 years ago on August 5, 1964. The front page of that day's New York Times reported, quote, President Johnson has ordered retaliatory action against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam after renewed attacks against American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, close quote. Of course, as historians now acknowledge, there was no second attack by North Vietnam, no renewed attacks against American destroyers. But as activist, author, and Fair Associate Norman Solomon has described, U.S. journalists reported those official claims as absolute truths, ignoring countervailing evidence and opening the floodgates for the bloody Vietnam War and the deaths of over 50,000 Americans and millions of Vietnamese. The official story was that North Vietnamese torpedo boats launched an unprovoked attack against the U.S. destroyer Maddox, which was on routine patrol in the Tonkin Gulf on August 2nd, and that North Vietnamese PT boats followed up with a deliberate attack 2 days later, firing 22 torpedoes on the Maddox and another destroyer, Turner Joy. President Johnson was on television that night telling Americans that, quote, aggression by terror against the peaceful villagers of South Vietnam has now been joined by open aggression on the high seas against the United States of America, close quote. He ordered retaliatory airstrikes, representing a momentous escalation of the war, and called for immediate passage of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which stated, quote, Congress approves and supports the determination of the President as Commander-in-Chief to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression, close quote. It's like grandmother's nightshirt. It covers everything, Johnson quipped. The House dispensed with hearings and approved in 40 minutes. The Senate took 2 days, finally voting 88-2 to adopt. But reality was very different from the tale that Johnson and the press told the U.S. public. The Maddox, which fired first in the earlier skirmish, was not on routine patrol. It was engaged in aggressive intelligence gathering maneuvers in sync with coordinated attacks on North Vietnam by the South Vietnamese Navy and the Laotian Air Force. And as for the second reported attack, the spark for the retaliatory airstrikes, it simply never happened. Many historians think the Maddox crew mistook their own sonar's pings off the rudder for North Vietnamese torpedoes. Johnson later joked they might have been shooting at whales. But it shouldn't surprise you to know that there was plenty of intelligence at the time suggesting that no attack had occurred. It was just overlooked and obscured, intentionally by warmongers in the government, but also by a credulous press. Sound familiar? Johnson's late-night speech won editorial praise. The president said the New York Times, quote, went to the American people last night with the somber facts, close quote. The Los Angeles Times urged Americans to, quote, face the fact that the communists, by their attack on American vessels in international waters, have themselves escalated the hostilities, close quote. As Tom Wells, author of The War Within, America's Battle Over Vietnam, recounts, U.S. media described the airstrikes that Johnson launched in response as merely tit for tat, when in reality they reflected plans the administration had already drawn up for gradually increasing its overt military pressure against the North. The distortion was due to media's almost exclusive reliance on U.S. government officials as sources of information and their reluctance to question official pronouncements on national security issues. Congress repealed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in January of 1971, but that didn't mean much since they continued to finance the war. And elite media, evidently, set about a studious forgetting of what columnist Sidney Shanberg called, 30 years later, in the midst of another war, the press corps' quote, unquestioning chorus of agreeability when Lyndon Johnson bamboozled us with his fabrication of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, close quote. Americans, Schonberg said, are, quote, the ultimate innocents. We are forever desperate to believe that this time the government is telling us the truth, close quote. That's an innocence, of course, that we can ill afford, and that journalists, above all, should fight the impulse to indulge. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We hear the numbers, something like 2.3 million people locked away in U.S. prisons and jails, nearly another million on parole, more than 3.5 million on probation. The numbers suggest the scale of things, but not the substance. They don't explain what happens to people in prison or broach the question of the societal purpose of incarceration so that one could ask whether it's being met. Though the subject of a lot of cultural fare, U.S. prisons remain opaque in important ways. And while you would hope that journalists would be especially curious about what's hidden, and some indeed are, overall it sometimes seems that while prisons put up barriers to access, some of media's barriers may be self-imposed. We need to know what's happening inside the supposedly public institutions of the criminal justice system. We also have to want to know. Heather Ann Thompson teaches at the University of Michigan in the Afro-American and African Studies and History Departments and the Residential College. She's author of Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City and of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy, which, among other accolades, won 2017's Pulitzer Prize in History. Thompson's article, What's Hidden Behind the Walls of America's Prisons, appeared last month on theconversation.com. She joins us now by phone from Detroit. Welcome to Counterspin, Heather Ann Thompson.
Great to be here.
Well, the state of public knowledge about prison conditions and the system more broadly is itself interesting. I hesitate to say things like most people don't know because, of course, millions of people know very well, especially when you start adding family members and friends of incarcerated people. But for those who don't have to know, that unawareness is by design. Prisons, you write, are built to be out of sight and are thus out of mind. Can you give us a sense of the history of the fight to be able to see inside, which is intertwined with the fight for prisoners' human rights?
Well, you're absolutely right to say that this is certainly a problem that many millions of people know firsthand, either because they're incarcerated or because of family members. But what's notable is that this is a situation that the voting public, by and large, doesn't know. And, of course, that's because we've disfranchised those folks inside and in many, many states, people even when they come home. So what's important here is that the portion of the population that gets to weigh in on whether or not prisons should exist as they do or how they're run are largely in the dark about what happens behind the walls. And that's always been the case, certainly throughout history. In American history, that's been the case. But in world history, in human history, it's not the case. You know, jails used to be in the center of the city. There was a great sense on the part of the broader population, you know, what went on in them. They could see them. They could see what happened inside. But throughout American history, we've really hidden the institution of prisons while we have made very public the supposedly the archetypical prisoner. So we've seen the prisoner on a chain gang, or we've seen the prisoner, you know, working beside the road picking up trash, often marked by a certain uniform or a certain way in which we know that they must have done something wrong. But we have absolutely no sense of what are these institutions they return to, and really never have. And so there have been various legal fights to try to get the public aware of what's happening inside, primarily because what's happening is brutal. And indeed, the public needs to know that because that's what they're paying for, right? As not just a confining of somebody, but often an abuse of someone, a torture of someone.
Right. And we can't have the conversation about whether we all agree that that's the purpose of incarceration. You know, we can't even get to that deeper conversation because we're not hearing about it. Well, what are the has some of the history been? You say it started, you know, in the 19th and 20th century. It was very clear that there was a hands-off doctrine. You just weren't supposed to know what was going on inside prisons. And because of concerns, people started to press and started to press. But when did anything official actually happen, illegal?
It really is not until the 1960s, and largely because journalists are pushing for their First Amendment rights of access, and because civil rights attorneys are shining the light inside of prisons via litigation, that we get any real sense of what's happening. And sometimes this occurred because of literal whistleblowing kinds of investigations. You know, you had, for example, in the South, prison reformers like Tom Merton who go into the southern prison plantations, and, you know, the idea is to reform them, but in the process of there's exposés done of them. And then, you know, in litigation, read depositions, or the public gets little snippets of what's going on. But by and large, our primary access is by filing Freedom of Information requests. And again, this is the legacy of the 60s. The problem is, even though these are state institutions overwhelmingly, or federal institutions, in other words, public institutions, these requests can be denied on the basis of, quote unquote, security. Well, of course, that can mean anything. And it often does mean anything that the prison administrators want it to mean. So access has been extremely difficult to have, despite legal tools on our side like freedom of information.
Well, it's interesting because it's so often presented as something, a right of prisoners and not as a right of the public, you know, to know. It's a, you know, the exposure is as though it's a gift to the incarcerated, you know.
Well, that's important. Exactly. Yeah. So notably, it's actually prisoners' First Amendment rights that raised a lot of these questions. In other words, the prisoner's ability to speak with a journalist or to speak with people on the outside was really the kernel, the core of so much of that initial push to get some kind of access. So protecting of the prisoners and prisoner rights law is where a lot of this comes from. Unfortunately, though, again, because those are so limited, journalists have come at it from a different direction, which is largely through the Freedom of Information Act. And between the two, you would imagine that we would pretty much know in any given prison, you know, first of all, you know, how people are being treated, how they're being fed, how many people are in solitary confinement, for how long, you know, these kind of basic facts about the inside of the institution. Not only do we not know, but we often only get a glimpse when horrific, horrific things happen. So whether that is in, you know, Tom Merton's expose of the Arkansas prison system in the 60s, whether it is at Attica prison in the 70s, whether it is in New Mexico State Prison in the 80s, or today, on a daily basis, we are reading about the St. Louis prison workhouse, or in Michigan recently, prisoner was just killed by a fellow prisoner for being homosexual. And, of course, this prisoner had been complaining to guards for weeks for protection. So it's just an example. We don't hear until someone is dead or harmed or, you know, severely abused before we hear.
Well, yes, you can't separate the question of access from the question of human rights. But, you know, for some people, there's no interest in reporting on abuses because, well, they're in prison and it's supposed to be bad. You know, when I was looking into different states vary, as you know, in terms of the access mm-hmm. that they give. And Rhode Island is a fairly open state. They're proud of the programs they have inside and the activities that they have in prisons. But they note that sometimes coverage brings a backlash. You know, why aren't they breaking rocks? You know, it sort of speaks to the poverty of the general conversation. And with that, I would say it's one of the other things that you talk about. It speaks to the idea that we don't seem to think about prisoners as ever coming home.
Yes, or even as people.
As
and
people.
I think that one of the reasons why we are now having these conversations much more seriously about access and about prisoner rights, and we really have not had this discussion, at least this robust of a discussion of prisoner rights since the 1960s and 70s. The reason for that is that, as you mentioned in your opening, we now have so many people, you know, some estimates upwards of 100 million people now with a criminal justice record, and so many people on the inside, and so many people that might go right back inside for the slightest infraction on parole, that this question of who prisoners are is now a little bit dicier than it has been at other moments in history. We can no longer just say, you know, that person, I don't know who those people are, I don't care who those people are. Often now, in many American families, including white middle-class families, those people are their children. Those people are people whom they recognize and identify with, and or with whom they identify. And so the upshot of this now is that access is becoming a family concern. And frankly, this idea that people should be sentenced and given the harshest treatment, I mean, we've always had that sentiment. And I know administrators experience it when they try to bring a reform to a prison. But the truth is that when people just stop for a moment and think, number one, you know, is the jury sentencing someone to being removed, or are they sentencing them to being tortured? And people have to be very clear that we don't live in a country where we sentence people to torture. And so what kind of a constitution do we have? What kind of a country do we want to have? That's the more the sort of theoretical or the ethical, moral questions. But then we bring it home and, you know, we ask ourselves, if our own kids did something untoward or illegal, what would we want their punishment to be? And so I think that the discussion is starting in part because the number of folks inside are becoming a little too large to say everyone's there for a good reason.
Right. Well, it should surprise no one that other countries don't do things this way.
Yeah, that's right. And that's another interesting thing that I tried to cover in this piece, is that the way in which we keep prisons separate from society is, it's certainly not uniquely American. There are many societies that don't put their prisons in the town square. But the idea that the public has no right to know what goes on inside of them is a very strange phenomena here. And let me be clear, you know, there are plenty of people who get inside. There are plenty of people, journalists and people providing services to prisoners and people visiting prisoners, but they've had to fight so hard for that access. And that's what's weird. We have institutions that we pay for, we fund, we support. And I would venture to say there are no other public institutions like that, with the exception of perhaps the military, that we put so much faith in with so little information about how they're actually run, what their outcomes are, and whether or not they merit that level of support.
Well, you say in the piece that you think access is a responsibility, even if it has yet to be a guaranteed right. That seems to be, to me, to be a call to journalists to amp up those efforts, not even just as individuals fighting, but perhaps, you know, as an entity. I guess I would like to see reporters being involved in pushing more broadly for daylight, you know, in these institutions.
Well, I say it's a responsibility because, frankly, that's how I come to this piece that I wrote as a historian. I have spent much time looking at episodes in our past where something pretty horrific has happened, and the only reason we know about it, and frankly, the only reason folks inside were protected to any degree, were because folks on the outside demanded access. And, you know, of course, you mentioned my book on Attica. That's the best example of that, where you had a prison protest for better conditions. The state of New York retook it with incredible force and set over the next weeks and days torturing people. And had it not been for the journalists and the lawyers and, frankly, even state politicians essentially banging on those doors on a daily basis, insisting upon access, what was a horrific situation would have been unimaginably worse. Indeed, the public was the only presence between a really an even worse massacre than occurred, because they kept saying, we need to get inside. These are human beings. What are you doing? What's happening? And frankly, today, there's been prison uprisings across the country, and it's a little disheartening. We don't see the public banging on the door saying, what is happening inside? There was a prison uprising in Delaware earlier this year, and one of the scariest things to me watching the outcome of it was that there was nobody showing up at that prison en masse, meaning the media, either national or, you know, international, as in the case of the 60s, saying, what's happening to the guys inside, right? What kind of retaliation is going on? What's happening to? We don't have a clue. We have no idea. But history shows us that whatever's happening is probably pretty ugly and certainly not within the bounds of our Constitution.
Well, we're coming up in a month or so on the anniversary of the uprising and massacre at Attica. Last year, around the anniversary, there was the largest prison strike in U.S. history. We noted at the time that national media largely ignored it. You said in something that I read that because of the mistruths told about the origins and the bloody end at Attica, Americans came to embrace justice policies and police practices that are again tearing the nation apart. You've started to tell us the story, but you know, it's 46 years ago now, so as strange as that is. What are, to you, the most significant misrepresentations or mistruths of what happened at Attica?
Well, here is the perfect case in point about why public access is so important. Even though at Attica, it was the state police that came in and killed 39 men, hostages and prisoners alike, and shot 128, tortured many more. Even though that's what in fact happened at Attica, the public was told that the prisoners had killed the hostages, that none of that torture had happened. And in fact, because they were told that the prisoners had caused such violence, the public says, you know what, forget civil rights for prisoners, forget human rights. It really ushers in, or at least certainly helps to fuel, this punitive spirit. So in this case, it wasn't even just that access would have prevented harm coming to real human beings, but the lack of access actually touches off decades-long misperceptions about, you know, who prisoners were and who law enforcement was. You know, not one member of law enforcement was ever held accountable for the killings at Attica. Most Americans think it's the prisoners that made Attica such a violent place. So access is about knowing how to get the future right, not just what's happening, you know, in that moment. And indeed, you rightly point out that these strikes happen, all these prison uprisings happen all over the country last year on the anniversary, and yet the national press didn't report on it. Well, if you ask most reporters the reason why that was, they will tell you, because we couldn't get any information.
Right.
You know, we had no idea what was really happening, so we chose not to report on it. The reporting didn't happen until the stories began trickling out, and frankly, that only happened because prisoner family members were talking. And that's a pathetic and really dangerous situation when that's the way we have to know how our public institutions are being run.
Well, I just want to bring it back to a point that we talked about earlier. Paul Wright from Prison Legal News was interviewed by NPR's Bob Garfield last year, and Garfield didn't seem persuaded that there was, as he put it, any compelling constitutional reason that reporters should have access to prisoners whose liberty has been legally taken from them. And it's, as we noted earlier, it's as if the daylight is only a kind of gift to the prisoner and not knowledge that the public is entitled to. And Wright says, Well, the Supreme Court may say no, but he, as a journalist, says yes. And it seems to come back again to this question of seeing it as a public right to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we care very much about the conditions of prisoners who are human beings, and that is itself a valid and compelling interest. But again, it also is, it's our right as a society to know what's being done in our name.
Well, it's all three, right? Because it's also the right of the human beings on the inside to be protected when they are utterly at the mercy of their captors. I mean, that is basic ethical human rights, not only ethos, but law, in fact. If you consider, for example, the UN's statement on the treatment of prisoners. So it's the prisoner's right to be protected. And by the way, that is a constitutional right. You do not lose your constitutional rights just because you were locked up. You may lose your voting rights, but you certainly don't lose your Eighth Amendment rights to be protected from cruel and unusual punishment. It is the journalist's right of access, and it is the public's obligation and right to know. So the sort of the triad means that we use freedom of information law, we use First Amendment law, but at the end of the day, none of that will be effective if the body popular does not make clear that we're not going to support or pay for institutions that we just have to accept on blind faith are doing what we want them to do, and in fact, not creating harm in our name. And so for that reason alone, I think that that's why I was hoping that the just general folks would say, you know what, yeah, we have an obligation. We have a right to know where our tax dollars and our faith goes.
We've been speaking with historian Heather Ann Thompson of the University of Michigan. The book is Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather Ann Thompson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You want the big picture? Here it comes. I picked two of my favorite power interviews from years of interviewing scientists, authors, and experts for you. You will hear a little-known professor from the University of Utah, Dr. Tim Garrett. He's a cloud specialist. But Garrett published a paper in America's most prestigious scientific journal after being championed by the father of global warming, Wally Broker. It still took 2 years to get out. Why? Because Garrett worked out that according to the laws of physics, only a complete collapse of civilization could save us now from devastating global warming. We'd rather keep on driving around than hear about that, I guess. I've tried. I got help from a Pakistani filmmaker to put out a YouTube video version of our 2010 Garrett interview. I spent hours typing out a transcript of it. We did a second interview, even more dynamite than the first. Hardly anyone has heard about it. You will. Then we'll go back to one of my favorite climate scientists, Dr. Peter Ward. He's got the history of life on this planet in his back pocket. Some of the long-term future, too. Peter Ward says nature isn't nice, and really, there isn't much of a plan. We can dream of an intelligent Gaian god already in command of the future to be. But the biological record, says Ward, is more like Mr. Bean is in charge. We need to get a grip on who we really are and where we really are. Last week, I ran clips from the former U.S. Treasury secretaries who say climate change will ruin any future economy. It was one of the most important stories so far this year. Now, we had some problems with the Radio EcoShock server, so if you missed the Crashing Climate News show, be sure to grab it from our SoundCloud page. We just passed 5,000 listens on SoundCloud. Not too bad for a startup a couple of months old. Thank you for tuning in there. So let's get to it. Here's Professor Tim Garrett with one of Radio EcoShock's greatest hits. Maybe energy conservation isn't enough. What if global warming is already an unstoppable force? Is economic collapse one of our only hopes? These disturbing questions arise in a controversial study by Tim Garrett, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi. Well, can you give us the title of your new paper and where people can find it?
The title of the paper is, Are There Basic Physical Constraints on Carbon Dioxide Emissions? And the article can be found on my website, perhaps most easily, which is easily found by either Googling Tim Garrett or going to the Atmospheric Sciences page at the University of Utah, or it can be found through the journal Climatic Change.
Okay, and I'll toss in a link to your webpage in my blog for this program. Well, look, I understand you applied some basic physics to the way our civilization works. Can you explain your theory for us?
Sure. I think the concept is easily understood in the light of perhaps looking at a growing child. And this is a familiar analogy, perhaps a good place to start, because if we think about a growing child, a child consumes energy, as does an adult, in order to maintain daily operations of that child. But what is a bit different with a child is that as the child uses the energy, it uses energy not only to maintain its current size, but also uses some fraction of that energy in order to grow its current size. And if it does that efficiently, then it is able to grow faster and thereby consume more energy rather than less energy in the future. And it's a very simple physical concept. It can be written down with basic thermodynamic arguments using equations. But as I showed, it can also be applied to civilization as a whole, treating civilization as being an energy-consuming organism. And if that is done, then it turns out that there is a very simple relationship between the rate of energy consumption by civilization as a whole and its economic value. It turns out that money is power, where power is the rate of energy consumption. There is a simple relationship of about 10 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted $1990 dollar. And that's really the key result, I think, that leads to the other results that I found in the paper.
And one of those was a suggestion that alternative energy like solar may not actually help stop climate change. And I've heard those doubts from other scientists and from an economist like Britain's Tim Jackson. So growth, even green technology, could just mean more energy is consumed. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the green technology, I think, is a slightly separate issue from the growth itself. The society will consume energy and probably try to maximize its growth regardless, whether it's green technology or not green technology. Perhaps the difference between green technologies and other types is that some of these green technologies aren't associated with carbon dioxide emissions. But as I pointed out, in order just to stabilize carbon dioxide emissions, the switch to non-CO2-emitting power sources would have to be very rapid, about 2.2% per year. So that works out to, just as an easy metric, one nuclear power plant per day.
Wow. Well, I don't think we're about to build a nuclear power plant per day, so we'll get in just a few minutes, I think, to what the other alternative could be. But I wanted first to raise the question, to everyone's surprise, you've said that we don't even need to calculate population growth or even the spread of higher living standard to know how things will go, that this energy is the key factor. That seems a bit hard to believe.
Yeah, it might seem hard to believe, but I mean, it's not that standard of living and population aren't part of the energy consumption by civilization. Obviously, people consume energy in commensurate to their standard of living. But the point is that our standard of living and how many people there are on the planet is really just a consequence of past energy efficiency. So to think about it another way, coming back to the growing child, I don't need to think about the cells, the number of cells in the child, or how much energy each cell consumes to know that the child will grow. And I can look at how much energy the child is consuming to get an idea of how fast the child will continue to grow. I don't need to know the details.
You've also described civilization as a heat engine. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, I think that's the basic idea. A heat engine is, well, it's a very familiar concept in thermodynamics or in physics. Everyone learns about it in their physics degree, if that's the path they take. And normally, a heat engine was, well, the idea was first coined in the 1800s when people were thinking about digging up coal or whatever it was. And you pop coal into an engine, and then it would do mechanical work to lift something or move something. In the case of civilization, we aren't trying to lift some external object. When we consume energy, we consume energy to do work for ourselves. So it's a slightly different heat engine than is a normal conception. Here there's a feedback loop. If we consume energy and do work with that energy, that work is done to enable us to consume more energy in the future. So there's a feedback that leads to growth in this situation, rather than just simply work being done on some external agency.
And meanwhile, our politicians continue to call us back to a growing GDP. That sounds like our carbon emissions will never really go down if that happens.
Well, in fact, if it's a growing GDP, that not only corresponds to accelerating growth of carbon dioxide emissions, but actually an interesting mathematical form, which is a super exponential growth. So it's not just exponential growth, but it is the exponent of an exponent. So emissions are not only accelerating, but the rate of growth is accelerating as well. And that's just an unavoidable consequence of a growing GDP.
And that's pretty believable when we hear about what's happening in China and India and all around the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's always a constant surprise. You see reports where the people who are measuring the CO2 are constantly surprised that CO2 emissions rates have continued to accelerate even when the scientists are hearing dire economic forecasts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, and we're about to explore whether economic collapse is the best way to save the biosphere, because we've talked about nuclear power. We need a new atomic plant every day, and that doesn't seem likely in time to avert catastrophic climate disruption, in my opinion. So that leaves economic collapse, and some deep greens, as you know, Tim, have called for this, but you're among the first academics that I know of to publish a peer-reviewed paper saying collapse may be necessary to save a habitable planet. Or am I putting words in your mouth? Maybe you didn't say quite that.
Well, not quite that, but that's what I did say is that if we are to ever stabilize emissions, that necessitates rather unpalatable, let's say, economic implications. If we are just to stabilize emissions, and I think this is a bit counterintuitive at first, but if we were just to stabilize the emissions, not so that they're decreasing, but just to stabilize them, the economy would have to be zero, adjusted for inflation. That does not mean that there wouldn't be economic activities going on, simply that none of these economic activities would add to the value of civilization. They would always be compensated for by some inflationary pressure. Now, I don't know what that world would look like. I've never lived in a world like that, but perhaps we can imagine by looking at some recent situations in places like Zimbabwe, where they ended up with hyperinflation, and it was a very different sort of life than we are used to ourselves in North America.
And so you looked at past development of civilization and applied your formula. Can you take the same formula and try and measure out how deep and how bad this collapse would have to be? I guess you've sort of expressed it right now, but could you enlarge on that, on what it would take to bring our carbon back to, say, 350? Can we figure that out?
Wow, I did run this once, and with some extremely drastic scenarios, I was able to see the model settle out at about 450 parts per million. But that would mean virtual complete economic collapse within my lifetime. I cannot imagine how it would be possible to get down to 350 parts per million. It seems implausible.
I gather it was hard to get this paper published until it came out in late 2009. What has been the reaction so far?
Well, the reaction I've got has been a fair bit of interest from people, interestingly enough, who are proponents of the peak oil theory. So for the peak oil fans, of course, finding some sort of basic link between the economy and rates of energy consumption is a very useful thing, because then they can relate it to their own understanding of the size and depletion rates of geological reservoirs of oil. Oh, that's heartening. I mean, it's nice to have when someone's interested in it. And other colleagues have found some interest, too, in just the basic thermodynamic framework. I think a lot of people have long had a suspicion that statements that increasing energy efficiency will lead to reduced energy consumption something's quite obviously wrong with that, because it runs counter to our experience. We've been increasing energy efficiency throughout history.
Yes, you mentioned Jevons' Law, I believe it was.
Yeah, Jevons' paradox, that's it. Yeah, I mean, Jevons was an interesting guy. He was extremely insightful, I think a bit too serious for his own good. He died at a year early age, I think, because he stressed himself out worrying about things. But yeah, he had this very insightful comment about the introduction of the steam engine, James Watt's steam engine, in the late 1800s. And he was saying this was, you know, a major efficiency gain, and it led to increased coal consumption rather than less coal consumption. And he made a very emphatic argument that any argument to the contrary was completely wrong.
And as I learned from your website, your real specialty is clouds. And listeners, you can find that link, as I say, to Tim Garrett's website in the Radio EcoShock blog. In my opinion, Tim, clouds are one of the last great frontiers of unknown science. Do you foresee a time when humans could control the clouds? And if so, should we?
There's actually a history to trying to control clouds, and even today people try to engage in something called cloud seeding, where they try to add silver iodide pellets to clouds in the attempt to accelerate their production of rain. Of course, this has agricultural benefits, and actually the field started with out of military interest. And it's been largely discredited simply because the amount of energy in a cloud is immense. It's something like many nuclear bombs going off at once. It's a huge amount of energy. You could power all of civilization if you could harness the energy off a few big clouds. So to imagine that we can control clouds seems a bit fanciful to me. And I know there are people who talk about it, but I'm highly skeptical.
Well, some have mentioned it as a form of geoengineering, as an alternative way to control the heat that reaches the Earth, but you don't really see a future for that in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my research is based on the ideas that these people are proposing, which are that if we add aerosol to clouds, then that will make them brighter and reflect more sunlight. And my belief is that we may make the cloud brighter here, but that would necessitate things becoming darker somewhere else, and that it would all be a wash once you consider the planet as a whole.
You know, Tim, I'm personally very resistant to recommending collapse as a solution. Billions of people would be hurt, and likely many would die. And I'm enjoying our civilization, including talking to you right now long distance. So how do you personally handle the ugly possibility that we may be at peak wealth right now with a downhill ride ahead of us?
Yeah, well, I've two young children, so it's on my mind. We're along for the ride. We will see what happens. And in the meantime, I guess I figure enjoy life while we can.
What are you working on now, and what would you like to research in the future?
Well, right now I'm about to submit a paper on how the Arctic becomes polluted and how clouds remove pollution from the Arctic. I would like to pursue more of this research on the thermodynamics of complex systems. I've applied this to all of civilization, and right now I would like to use the same sort of framework to understand the development, growth, and death of clouds. I think the same principles can be applied, whether it's to civilization, to clouds, to a child, or whatever it is. We all live and die by the first and second laws of thermodynamics, so these principles should be quite general.
It might be interesting to apply it to cities as well, since most of us are living in cities and there are huge thermodynamic flows happening in cities themselves.
That hasn't been done quite from a thermodynamic standpoint, but it has been from a mathematical standpoint. And in fact, when I mentioned earlier the concept of super-exponential growth, there has been a recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy, well, I guess it's 2 or 3 years old now, that highlighted super-exponential growth being one of the defining characteristics of successful cities.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Find this interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to the best of Radio EcoShock as I put out the key interviews from years of chasing down the truth about the truth. Stay tuned for more. Hello, I'm Alex Smith with a serious question for you. What if the past determines our future? Are we humans headed for success or lasting economic depression, perhaps on an overheated planet? Dr. Timothy Garrett is Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. In February 2010, Tim joined us on Radio EcoShock to discuss his disturbing new scientific paper. It outlined a direct relationship between the energy we burn, the wealth we create, and the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now he's gone a step further with some new work. So, Dr. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I think we should start with your original formula for energy and wealth. Can you take a shot at explaining that for the intelligent listener?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started just as a simple query as to where the economic value comes from. And, you know, coming from a physics background and being really totally naive in economics, I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the rate of energy consumption by civilization. In other words, perhaps that our wealth, the wealth of civilization, has a direct link to how much energy we can consume. To me, that seemed like a reasonable assumption, because in order for us to do anything, which I suppose is perhaps a measure of our wealth, we need to consume energy. That's a basic law of the physical universe. It is through energy transformations that anything happens. And so what I tried to do was just simply look at this using some available data, and it turned out that this relationship is in fact fixed, that there is a constant relationship of about 10 milliwatts that is required to support every inflation-adjusted $1990 dollar of economic value. And that was the core result of the first paper I did into this. And what I tried to do was go from there to see what this implied for subjects such as global warming, which are closer to my primary field of research in atmospheric sciences.
Well, based on everything we know so far, if we grow the economy, as every politician promises, we'll put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But what if the economy crashes? Will we put less up there, or will we reach safe levels if we have a severe downturn?
Well, this is where my work differed slightly from perhaps what other people are thinking. Now, the way I define wealth is that it is the accumulation of our past production of economic value. So what we have today is an accumulation of what we've been able to do in the past. Now, when you talk about the economy declining, well, usually what people think about is they think about GDP going down, the gross world product declining with time. And what I showed was that if the GDP declines with time, which is ordinarily what we would think of as being a depression, this would not, in fact, correspond to lower carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, carbon dioxide emissions would need to grow. Instead, in order for carbon dioxide emissions to go down, what would be required is effectively a complete collapse of the economy. A collapse in the sense that the gross world product would have to be almost completely offset by inflation. So that, in some sense, it would seem strange to an economist to think about this, but in some sense, the global product would have to be negative rather than positive. In other words, we'd have to be in a situation of net consumption rather than net production. We are consuming more of what we have produced in the past rather than producing new, increasing wealth. So that's a rather extreme situation, but this is what the data bears out as being required to have lower carbon dioxide emissions.
So if I understand it correctly, your definition of wealth does not include the sort of fantasy money that, like the quantitative easing from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but it includes everything that humans have produced that's still here from the beginning of time. I mean, even the Pantheon in Rome would be part of our accumulated wealth at this point.
Yes, yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I part of my wealth is my house, but the house was produced back in 1926.
You have a new paper submitted to the journal Climatic Change, and the title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide. And you do go a step further here, predicting, it seems to me, almost the worst of all worlds, high levels of greenhouse gases and inflation. I still don't really get what inflation has to do with climate change.
I was actually just down in New Orleans for a scientific meeting, and I spent some time after that with my family. And we went to some local museums, and of course in New Orleans, you know, there's the lasting legacy of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And with Katrina, as it was with, you know, perhaps all natural disasters are, historically, they've been inflationary. What they do is they destroy past production while people perhaps still have the dollars in their pockets, but there are fewer things available for their dollars to be matched to. So the cost of what is present as it goes up in cost. Now, this wasn't actually how I approached it in the paper, but I think this was how an economist would normally approach the topic. The way I approached it in the paper was that I showed that environmental destruction, whether it's by disease or by weather or whatever it is effectively a decay on our past production that devalues what we have, and that is effectively an inflationary pressure. Now, what you can think about global warming being is, in some sense, it's like a long-term natural disaster. It is not only a long-term natural disaster that happens continuously, unlike Katrina, which was momentarily, but it also happens globally. So with Katrina, it was instantaneous, effectively instantaneous, and they caused a short-term inflation. But then people were able to come in from outside and provide new resources that stabilized the New Orleans economy. Now, I was in New Orleans, things were expensive still, but, you know, it wasn't out of this world. But in a future world, you can imagine, now, this is slightly speculative, but it's consistent with what you would expect from the physics. You could imagine that there is an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And this will be an inflationary pressure that cannot be supplanted by outside resources from outside. Because it is acting globally, it will be affecting everybody.
Right. If we have rising seas, for example, eating up some of our best farmland or salinating it, there's just, you can't make some more land like that. It's gone.
Exactly.
So that pushes up the price of all the remaining land, and that's how climate change can create inflation, for example.
Yes.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down. And eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million. And that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did. And then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming, at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
Well, I hear people suggesting that we could make a big cut in carbon emissions just with energy efficiency. We'll all get electric cars and we'll put in the light bulbs. And I've heard that you don't think so much about energy efficiency as a way to save ourselves.
Well, actually, it's almost counterintuitive. But no, in fact, it's the other way around. The whole reason that civilization has been so successful and has grown so quickly is that we are energy efficient. It is our efficiency of taking material goods and energy and converting them into production and net growth that actually leads to us producing carbon dioxide. The increasingly efficient we become, the more efficient we become at growing civilization and its wealth. I think this is actually common sense. I mean, we always strive for efficiency because we have some underlying sense that efficiency is good for our general well-being. But our general well-being is normally measured in terms of economic wealth. And as I showed, economic wealth has a direct correspondence to carbon dioxide emissions. So increasing energy efficiency leads to more energy consumption, and more energy consumption leads to more carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has actually been pointed out by energy economists ever since the late 1800s. So I'm not sure why it's not more generally accepted today.
You know, the study of economy has been called the dismal science, and your paper might qualify for that title. The abstract reads, "There are no plausible thermodynamically supported solutions that avoid inflation rates less than 100% and lead to stabilized atmospheric CO2 concentrations within this century." To me, that says we either get worthless money or a dangerous atmosphere or both. Are these our choices?
I don't see any other options. I mean, I suppose what you could argue is that civilization could decarbonize, switch to renewables and nuclear power at such an extraordinarily fast rate that in some sense we decouple ourselves from the atmosphere. So in other words, we are able to keep consuming energy without affecting atmospheric composition. But even there's actually, I mean, in some sense it's rather amusing. Well, it's intellectually amusing at least, that decarbonizing civilization will actually not be as effective as one might expect. Now, decarbonizing civilization, let's say we were to do this proactively, presumably it would cost money, and we would only do it with the expectation that it would help alleviate the worst damages of global warming. And I think that makes sense. You know, why would we do it otherwise? We would put in the effort because it will benefit us in the long run. But remember, anything that benefits us in the long run is effectively measurable as an increase in our wealth. And an increase in our wealth will translate to an increase in energy consumption. So in essence, what happens is decarbonizing promotes our wealth and our energy consumption in the future. But increasing our energy consumption, as long as we are partly a fossil fuel economy, will correspond to increasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So this doesn't completely offset the decarbonization gains, but because it promotes society health, we actually do not gain as much from decarbonizing as one might initially expect, because it's a dynamic system and we would actually continue to grow faster than we would otherwise.
I can see it. I mean, if we build a lot of nuclear power plants, it's going to take some carbon shovels to get all that cement going, and all the materials still have to be brought out. We're going to use oil to do it. And so there might actually be a burst of new emissions just trying to do that.
Well, yeah, there's that too, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is, in some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter. Just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds than clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time. And because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s. And it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks. And these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds that and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
You know, you're kind of a troublemaker in a way here. Because we've got a lot of people who are looking for a realistic way out of this awful dilemma, and you've got a really sharp mind that seems to be you can stick some pins in the balloon and away it goes. But I guess that really is what science is about. I mean, we're looking for what is real and what works and what doesn't.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, these are interesting physics problems. And I mean, one of the privileges of, you know, being a university scientist is, of course, that, I don't know, you get to think about these problems for the simple joy of thinking about them. And if the answers end up one way or rather than the other, well, that's well, so be it. I mean, it's the joys in trying to figure something out. Yeah, I mean, that's for me, that was the fun of doing the economics problem. I mean, I have no background in economics, but I am as much a player as anybody else in the economic system. And wouldn't it be fun if it is possible to understand the economic system using the tools that, well, I, as a physicist, understand from my research in doing clouds.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Tim
Garrett. You very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of biology, as well as earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Peter last joined us on our December 9, 2008 program for a discussion of his book, Under a Green Sky. Now he's back with a new idea, sure to rattle a lot of people. It's called the Medea Hypothesis. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thanks so much for having me again.
Well, your new book picks a fight with a beloved scientist, Sir James Lovelock. Can you explain Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, and then we'll get to your answer to it?
Yeah, the Gaia hypothesis is really a wonderfully introspective, I would say, from both a mental and a psychological point of view, hypothesis about how the world works and how nature works. And introspective in the sense that it has, by itself, entirely spawned what we call New Age or New World religions. It really has a sense that the Earth is alive, and or the Earth and its systems act in such a way to better or optimize the planet for life itself.
And I gather that it's now split up into two versions that you take on in your book.
Yeah, there's always been an extreme fringe, and Lovelock himself is really one of the amazing intellects of the 20th century, although for a variety of reasons, I think some of his 21st century ideas are getting increasingly batty, and I'll go into these in a minute. But it also split off into the whole New Age business, which he never advocated. And the most extreme view of Gaia is that the Earth itself, including all the hard stuff that most of the Earth is made up of, is part of a living being, that we are one gigantic living planet with this thin veneer of gas and life itself over this much thicker, rocky planet, but the whole thing's alive. And that not even Lovelock himself really advocates that, although in the past he's dabbled in that. The other is that there are many systems equivalent to, say, our organ systems or our blood system, which maintain life, and that through time the whole makes it better for the individual.
And I guess that even that branch has split into that which optimizes the planet for life and that which merely regulates the planet somehow using biological means so that life can continue.
Yeah, that's really, you've hit it beautifully, actually. That really is the division that goes on. How much is optimization? How much is just letting life continue? I don't think anyone argues with the fact that life influences the planet. It influences geology. It influences the gas of the atmosphere. It has all of these effects on the physical world, and that obviously vice versa, the physical world has effects on biology. That's almost the weakest kind of Gaia hypothesis, is that there is this interaction. No one disputes that. On the other hand, the sense that life itself is making the world better for future life is the other aspect, and that's really where James Lovelock is. It's kind of like you buy a house and or rent a hotel room, if you will, and then while you're there in that hotel, you paint it and clean it up and put in new furniture and spend all this money on it so that the next guest has even a better hotel room. I mean, that's not really what a lot of us think that life is doing here.
So by contrast to that, what is the Medea hypothesis?
Well, Medea is the worst Greek mother, because Gaia is the name that Lovelock came up with for the good mother, and it was the Greek idea of good mother Earth. And I just almost tongue-in-cheek, but not too much, came up with this idea of Medea. And from Greek literature, we know of Jason and the Golden Fleece. He ran off with King Aetes, who had stolen the fleece, his daughter Medea, married Medea, and Jason, it turns out, was a pretty good captain and a really bad husband. And Medea, in a fit of pique, murdered their children several years later when Jason found himself flirting with other queens. So if you want a bad mother, Medea is probably about the worst. And the sense is not so tongue-in-cheek. Because of the mass extinctions and other episodes in Earth history, Mother Earth has murdered her children over and over and over again.
And I remember in your book, Under a Green Sky, you came to this chunk of rock that looked like about, if I remember correctly, about 10 million years, where there was practically not much alive left in the fossil record, at least. That must be very startling to look at.
Oh, absolutely. And those were the seeds that brought Medea, at least in my own mind, to life, is when you look at these long intervals of time after mass extinction, it sure doesn't look like life has been optimizing the planet for much of anything. We really go back to a microbial world, and we have a sense that it's not getting better. It's just getting worse. And when life does come back, it's different life. I mean, you can't say better, you can't say worse, but you can certainly say different.
One of the great things about this book, in my opinion, is your ability to summarize and teach us the latest cutting-edge earth science. There have been some really remarkable discoveries just in the last couple of years. I'd like to get into some of that brain food. But could you start by explaining what you see as a possible flaw in evolution that could end up wrecking our living planet?
Well, it's funny you say that. It was one of the first lectures I gave about this. I gave a trial tune-up to my department, which is composed of a lot of really good biologists, and one of the best, a man named Joe Felsenstein, who's a National Academy member evolutionist, sort of raised his hand up and said, well, you know, after you've given this presentation and knowing what I know about life, you're giving way too much chops to this Medea. I think evolution is really kind of a dumb tinkerer and kind of blunders from place to place. And he suggested that I call it not the Medea hypothesis, but the Mr. Bean hypothesis, that evolution is just this dumb blunderer. And that actually might be a much better sense of what happens, is that there are these evolutionary breakthroughs, and sometimes they're better for the species, more often they're worse, but quite often they have an effect on the entire ecosystem. A new species doesn't care what it does to anything else. It just wants to reproduce, make more of itself. We talk about the selfish gene. Well, I think we really need to talk about the selfish species.
I guess we're a prime example, but also some of the bacteria would take over if they could.
Absolutely, and they've been here before. They will be here again. There is a certain finite, a definite finite limit to the age of animals, just that is dictated by the nature of our enlarging sun, by the nature of an aging Earth. Everything's finite. Well, so too is the age of animals, and the bacteria are laying in wait to take back the planet that advanced animal life took from them 500 million years ago.
I'd also like to imagine a mass extinction caused by a greenhouse effect. I don't think the public has any idea of what that might be like. Can you give us some clues of what happened?
Yeah, when I wrote Under a Green Sky, I tried to put out some op-ed pieces or something about this, and I was sort of viewed as a fringe lunatic, and that, although that may definitely still be the case, finally, actually, some people are waking up because of a whole raft of independent studies, both from the past mass extinctions, but what is happening on our planet today. I mean, I suggested a greenhouse extinction just occurs when the planet warms up enough that the poles and the tropics are so similar in temperature that it slows down ocean currents. Slowing ocean currents causes the ocean to lose its oxygen. An oxygen-free ocean spawns a group of bacteria that animals don't like. In fact, these bacteria can kill off animals. Well, we're starting to see that right now. We have a warming poles, and the poles are warming radically faster than the tropics. Tropics just can't warm much warmer. The poles can warm up all the way to the temperature of the tropics. And so you have this asymmetry. The asymmetry is causing the heat difference between the polar regions and the equator to drop, and as that drops, there's less impetus for wind and current. As things stagnate, oxygen stops being pumped into the ocean. And there you go. So NASA got hold of this. A bunch of us were taken down to NASA Ames at the behest of the director there, saying, look, is this a bunch of nonsense or is it possible? And 15 scientists were invited, and every one of them stood up and said, you know, this is looking pretty bad. In fact, it's looking like it could happen way faster than anybody's suggesting, including a slowdown to the point of near cessation of the Pacific gyres starting next century. So it's definitely happening.
Well, I thought about you and your theory when I was listening to a lecture, one of the lectures at the Oxford Beyond 4 Degrees Climate Conference that was just held at the end of September, and Professor John Schellnhuber was talking about oxygen-free zones that were developing in the Indian Oceans at key levels where fish would live. And I thought, whoa, I wonder if that's the beginning of this.
It absolutely is. I mean, that conference scared everybody because simply the fact that there would be 4 degrees, and that's 4 degrees centigrade, by 2060, it has to be such a wake-up call. And yet the United States right now is so tied up in blocking health care, there's no conversation about a far more important bill in my mind, which is the climate bill, the climate change bills. Those things are just stalled. And we really are facing some very bad times, not for us. I mean, everybody who hears this program, we're fine. Our children and their children and their children are not going to be fine.
We're talking with Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. Peter, in this work, you also gave me my first image of the natural future of this planet and the time limit that all life lives under. How long have we got, Doc?
500 million years. I was at a science fiction convention where one of the science fiction writers looked at me and said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, why? She said, well, why would anybody care about a 500 million years from now? And my thought was, well, look, you know, there's no reason that species have to go extinct. We don't have a gene in us that says you're going to go extinct in 2 million years. That doesn't happen. We have that aging gene that kills us, but species don't. We have bacteria on this planet that have not changed, as far as we can tell, in 3.5 billion years. And there's no reason that we as humans couldn't stay and engineer this planet until the ultimate end of Earth is going to be in 7 or 8 billion years when the sun goes red giant. But we've got billions of years if we keep our wits about us, literally.
Well, I could buy that in the long run, but I have to tell you, I'm a little worried about the call for geoengineering in the short run. Some of the right-wing think tanks and even the oil companies are getting on board with geoengineering as a way to bypass carbon controls and Copenhagen Treaty. So it's we have to... And should we really turn the Earth over to the people who can't run an economy or even a train system? It worries me a bit.
Well, that worries me a lot. But let's expand the sense of geoengineering and say that planting a tree is one of the most profound and efficient methods of geoengineering. What we're talking about is changing the natural order out of what, say, Mother Nature would have produced at this moment and amplifying. I think, again, we need to regulate and we need to control our atmosphere. We need to. If I had one button that I could make that everybody on Earth ought to have, it would be save the ice sheets. I mean, nothing else. Save the ice sheets. Because as go the ice sheets, goes human civilization. If we melt any further of our Antarctic and our Greenland ice sheets, and not ice caps, anything floating on the ocean is sea level neutral, but melting the continental ice sheets causes sea level to rise or fall or rise or fall. And look, the near-term problem is we're about to head to 9 billion people. If we raise sea level even 2 meters, we've reduced an enormous amount of agriculture. So you have the intersection of 9 billion people with, say, one quarter reduction in food somewhere in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's disaster. That is total disaster. And that's really the greatest single challenge facing us is the short-term sea level rise, agriculture, and too many mouths to feed.
And the biological level, another strange idea for me in your book is that we may not be living in the great age of plant and animal life, but rather in a declining old age of life on this planet. How did I get the idea from so many scientists that we were right now at the peak, the great green golden age of life?
It's funny how all these preconceived notions just go by the wayside. When I was raised in my first classes, I always read, even as a boy, that the way evolution worked is first there were fish, and then fish gave rise to amphibians, and we had the great age of amphibians, and we had the age of reptiles, and then an age of mammals. And yet the fossil record tells us that the age of mammals, the first great age of mammals, preceded the dinosaurs. The mammal-like reptiles, the first true mammals of the late Permian age, were wiped out by a greenhouse extinction. Dinosaurs were just a big mistake. There should have never been this age of dinosaurs, but for this very nasty, volcanically produced, very anti-Gaian, very pro-Medean greenhouse extinction that ended the Permian.
Just getting back to the hypothesis, how do you judge things to be Medean versus Gaian, just so our listeners can tune into that idea?
Well, again, the whole Medean scheme of things is that life blunders around, and that there's really no, say, planning, there's no sense of optimizing, there's no plan, if you will. Optimization indicates there's a plan somewhere, that somehow things are naturally or unnaturally running according to some plan. Well, there's no planning. I mean, evolution is just this dumb tinkerer sort of bouncing around. Things that work well do well for a while until natural changes of the planet and the system makes other things do well. But this sense that there's optimization taking place, I think, is ridiculous. And what it does, it's like a false crutch. And this is where I just am getting on the case of Dr. Lovelock, is that he has this sense now that Gaia will take care of all the human problems. He used to say that it would be by wiping out the humans, and he keeps going back to that. I personally think we're pretty much extinction-proof. I think the technology is going to make us essentially immune to most of the things that kill most species. Now, it doesn't say extinction-proof means happy. It doesn't mean that we're going to have rich lives. It just might mean that our species goes on for a very long time. But Dr. Lovelock in Seattle was on radio saying the most unbelievable things, saying that right now China is buying up Africa because in the next 20 to 30 years, China will transfer all its population to Africa. Now, he said this publicly on the radio and then in front of a crowd. Now, he's right in saying that climate change is a big problem, but when you say that China is about to colonize Africa with a straight face, I mean, you lose a whole lot of credibility. So anyway, it just seems I'm raging against this particular machine because he's a beloved man, it's a beloved theory, and I think it really gives us a crutch that shouldn't be used.
Well, it was helping the environmental movement to be able to get people through to the idea that there's more than strip malls in your job and that, in fact, we may be connected to all of the species, that we have some sense of ourselves as life on this planet. And I don't think that would be harmful. What's your take?
No, I absolutely agree with this. I mean, we are certainly just natural creatures, but now we have technology that nothing else has had. So I hate this sense that humans are not part of the natural chain of being, but I do recognize that we do produce spaceships and we do pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere far faster and far more vigorously than any volcano, than all the volcanoes that have ever been on the planet. It's that double-edged sword again. I think we really need to recognize the size of our footprint clunging through here. But secondly, we recognize we are on a dying planet and that either we die with it or we engineer our way through it.
So in the book, you have a little bit of a sneer for the Al Gores of this world and blast for certain kinds of back to pre-industrial life and environmentalists. Are you having a problem with some environmentalism?
Well, I have problems in the sense that people say that let's just take it back to the way it was. And if people are willing to give up the clothes that we have, the transportation, the communication, but most readily, if people are willing to see half of their babies die and die horribly from childhood diseases, if people are willing to see life expectancy go back to 35 years old and willing to see misery during that 35 years, yeah, let's go back to nature. So we're not going to do that. I think I'm a parent. Parents will just not let that happen. So let's be realists. We're not going to go back to nature. We need to contain the problems that we produce. We need to recognize what we're doing, but I think we need to be realists. And I don't think the environmental movement is being realistic about much of what it wants to do.
We've been talking with Peter Ward. He's the author of the new book, The Medea Hypothesis, and it's published by Princeton University Press. And I notice on the inside page there, it says that you were selected by a group of scientists at the National Academy to write this book. So I think that puts you well beyond the crank level and somebody with some new things that we all need to know about. Peter Ward, thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for great questioning.
All right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this full interview anytime as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. This is a Radio EcoShock replay show. You've heard two interviews from Professor Tim Garrett on why civilization must crash or else. Those were in 2010. Then Dr. Peter Ward with his Medea Hypothesis, The Mad Drive of Blind Biology, from the October 16, 2009 Radio EcoShock show. I'll put links to these interviews in my show blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. That's ecoshock.info. Last week, we also ran a convincing interview about the high danger of Arctic methane with Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge. That is part of a longer interview done by Nick Breeze. I mistakenly said the film was for AMIG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, but really it's a private venture by Nick Breeze, and we can expect to see more in a sort of feature film from him coming up. Follow up on Nick's work and more of his videos at envisionnation.co.uk. That's envisionnation.co.uk. Thank you so much, Nick. It may be summer holidays, but the climate news keeps on rolling in. New York State has tornadoes now, when it never did before. The whole water cycle of Canada's Midwest has shifted, with floods in July instead of spring. Waterways that were always bone dry this time of year just hit record high levels. What could it be? Meanwhile, North America's West keeps on baking in record heat and drought, while the East seems to be re-experiencing something like the polar vortex with cooler than normal temperatures for a little while. Even mainstream media can see the jet stream has changed its character from anything we've known before. It's just another strange coincidence, isn't it? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.
And we are joined once again by David Jacobs. Now, David, you have practiced international law. You have argued many of these cases. You were involved in them. Many, many lawyers here came to the fore and argued about the treatment of Rwandan refugees in this country who ended up being removed because Ottawa was happy to do anything that President Kagame, former General Kagame, wanted in Rwanda. But the British courts have not been so compliant as, I gather, as the Canadian courts. What is this decision, and why did you think it? Why do you think it matters? People know about it.
Well, I do think it matters. The decision, I'm not quite sure how to tell people to find it. If you were to, the names are a little difficult, but I'm going to spell out one of them. I think if you Google. I'm going to spell this out rather than.
How about the lawyer?
Well, if you Google Ntezirayo, Ntezirayo. Yeah, Ntezirayo. So, five people. The government of Rwanda tried to extradite five people from the UK, Rwanda nationals, for trial in Rwanda on various charges related to. The events in 1994, the mass killings there. They had had a hearing with extensive evidence before a judge called Arbuthnot, who at that time was deputy senior district judge, now is senior district judge in England. So they were unsuccessful before the senior district judge, and so appealed the decision to the High Court of Justice, Queen's Bench Division in the UK. They were unsuccessful in their appeal. And the judgment is interesting for a number of reasons. Now, I have to confess, it is a monumental judgment which deserves a full reading and analysis, which I haven't had time to commit the analysis to. It is hundreds of paragraphs so many pages.
So but can you tell us who he is and what they were trying to do to him and why the court said they...
Well, the government of Rwanda was trying to extradite five witnesses who had all been charged in Rwanda with various offenses. I'm going to have a difficulty with the name, and I apologize. Ntezirayo was a burgomaster in Mudasamwa commune in Gikongoro province. And it was alleged that he told people to set up roadblocks during 1994 to kill Tutsis, and Tutsi bodies should be hidden, and that he'd given out weapons and so on and held meetings and so on. This is, for people who are at all familiar with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, these are exactly the kind of allegations that are made against every one of the accused. Mm-hmm. So this is a very, very balanced and frankly, diplomatically written judgment. Which relies on evidence of Canadian lawyers, a number of Canadian lawyers, by the way, who were involved in proceedings before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And what the senior district judge found was that there was a risk of interference from pressure exerted by ministers of the Rwandan government who made comments in public and in the press about the case. While she thought that risk would be reduced if there was a robust, able, and experienced defense team, not just that, but a team with an ability to investigate defense cases and with robust international monitoring, she thought those problems of the prejudicial comments by the government of Rwanda could be ameliorated. But she found that wasn't the case. She found that if extradited, all these defendants would be denied effective representation of counsel. There wasn't sufficient funding for defense investigations, and it was difficult for counsel to find witnesses and so on. She found that there were problems as to whether the judges were independent and so on. Mm-hmm. They reviewed the evidence of a number of people. Some of whom I guess are just characters who didn't give evidence but had some reports. One of them was a man called James Arguin, A-G-A-R-G-U-I-N, who was an American lawyer who was appointed chief of the appeals and legal advisory division of the Office of the Prosecutor in the ICTR. And he is the person who directed litigation related to referral proceedings. Now, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda did refer a number of cases that were before it to Rwanda. That is, they extradited people from the seat of the ICTR in Arusha, Tanzania, to Kigali. And
so you're saying this court, the London court, would not do that?
They didn't do that, and they considered in some detail what the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda did. And they say about Arguin, by the way, he's never, this is, I'm quoting from the judgment, he's never been questioned orally in any case of which we're aware. If he were to be questioned, we consider he'd be liable to be pressed as to whether part of his responsibility was to try to achieve the objectives of the UN Security Council. In other words, transfer the caseload to Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they say in diplomatic terms that they're not saying that the ICTR was so influenced by the UN Security Council, essentially wanting to wind up the ICTR and so on. But they say you have to think about it, basically, you know, why they did all that. So what they say about the ICTR is of tremendous interest. Get to this. They say that the government of Rwanda advanced the decisions of the ICTR, and let me quote this. It's clear that the government of Rwanda has advanced the decisions of the ICTR with a powerful rhetorical flourish. If the ICTR has agreed to transfer cases, who are you to refuse? In an unpersuasive piece of advocacy, Mr. Lewis for QC, for the government of Rwanda, did so to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, they say, it's an inevitable important context for decisions of the ICTR that if trials will not continue indefinitely, then the only destination for such places apart from Francois would be Rwanda.
Yeah.
But they go on then to discuss what's happened in cases where people were actually transferred. And I won't go through all of them, but all of them, they come to the conclusion in about a number of cases for which evidence was given, and there were transfers from the ICTR, or in the case of Mugesera, from Canada,
yes,
that these people did not receive fair trials, and they didn't receive adequate defense. So let me just turn to Mugesera, if you don't mind.
Please.
Mugesera was, again, deported from Rwanda to Canada. Assurances were given to our courts before his deportation. Martin Ngoga, who I think is the Attorney General, I think you might know.
Yes.
Attorney General, gave an assurance that the case would qualify as a transfer case from Canada, giving rise to all the safeguards attendant on a transfer from the ICTR. By the way, those safeguards proven useless. But as people might recall, this is a case where the Federal Court of Appeal in Canada found that that the extradition request was improper on the facts, and that the facts didn't lead to shouldn't lead to a finding against Dr. Mugesera, and he shouldn't be deported. And that was reversed by the Supreme Court of Canada, and he was deported. So what happened in Mugesera? In Mugesera, in Rwanda, no defense witnesses were called. None. And the judge found the evidence I've read, this is a senior district judge who's being appealed from, the evidence I read and heard leave me with considerable reservations as to whether the assurances given by the government of Rwanda to Canada are being respected and whether Dr. Mugesera's trial is fair. The appeal court then says, for our part, we've seen no satisfactory answer to these conclusions from the government of Rwanda.
Well, that makes me really wish that lawyers and judges here, and particularly the would review this matter, and because a lot of claims were made, and now we have a British court of considerable significance and serious difference of opinion.
Well, if your listeners and yourself don't mind me reading, this is from the conclusion, This is the appeals court saying this. We reject firmly the submission of the government of Rwanda that the judge, that's the senior district judge, should have unequivocally have stated that the Rwandan judiciary was independent and that there was no risk of bias or interference in these cases because they're not political cases. This is the appeals court speaking. The clearly authoritarian nature of the Rwandan regime, the long and continuing history of influence of political will over the justice system where the case is perceived to matter, the evidence of Gahima and others, this is as to threats and intimidation, the evidence of threats arising from criticism of the regime, not in a political context, but in the context of the justice system. The Osman warnings, I better stop at the Osman warnings, that's a British thing where the British special services, I'm sorry, I'm not getting the name right, are required to go and tell somebody that they're under threat from foreign government. And there were a number of people, including a man called Rene McGenzie and others.
David Himbara, who lives now in
Toronto. Well, David, it was in Canada.
It was there. It was in London.
I'm not sure they mentioned Himbara in here, but they do mention a number of people who gave evidence about being given these warnings. And, of course, they mention that Christopher Black, a Toronto lawyer who's been on your show, was given a similar warning by CSIS in Canada that there were credible threats to his life, as well as to these other people. So that's what's called the Osman warnings. And then the experiences of witnesses who gave evidence in genocide cases unfavorable to the prosecution, whether in Rwanda or abroad, all these point to a high level of risk of pressure within the system. They say that the fact that ICTR sent a number of cases back to Rwanda is important but not conclusive. It's not clear the ICTR had access to the amount of quality of evidence which was referred to in the court before or available to us.
I'm very glad to get this. By the way, I didn't mean to interrupt. Was there another point you wanted to make there?
Well, there was one more. The Rwandan court was the ICTR was satisfied with the fact that, well, they would send it back and people would monitor what happened in those courts. But the senior district judge said that those monitors rarely make comments on what they see, so they're not reliable sources when the quality of work is being considered. And in the Uwinkindi case, one of those that was sent back from ICTR to Rwanda, the ICTR monitor raised the possibility with Uwinkindi, for example, that the Rwandan prosecution would speak to his defense witnesses and secure them for him, I suppose, in the alternative defense doing it. And he told her he'd rather die than provide the names of his witnesses to the prosecution. The other thing that's pointed out is that the president of the successor to the ICTR said that the monitors had to limit themselves to providing objective information regarding possible violations or impediments to fair trial and refrain from giving any opinion regarding such violations or impediments unless otherwise directed. So their mandate was somewhat limited. I mean, in the conclusion, the court didn't rely on the ICTR, nor, frankly, on the Canadian courts, but relied on a mountain of objective evidence that you couldn't get a fair trial in Rwanda. The judiciary was there was a mountain of external pressure. The defense couldn't conduct its case. The lawyers were not being compensated. The legal aid system didn't work. Lawyers were not given money to look for witnesses or anything like that. So
that seems like a pretty very clear.
Very clear. Well worth reading.
And last thing, David Jacobs, we have to say there was a lawyer named Diane Ellis. She seemed to lead this and did a brilliant job, didn't she?
She did a brilliant job, and the court praises her and says how persuasive her advocacy was as she put together some tables as to what happened that the court relied on.
We have to leave it there.
Okay.
I just want to make sure we called out Diana Ellis for her work. Thanks very, very much.
Excellent lawyer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It's a Taylor Report. See you next not next week. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the Trump administration's tax reform plan, which will primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans. Masada Dizenhouse, North American Organizing Director with the climate group 350.org, who explains why her organization and others oppose California's recently passed cap-and-trade legislation. And Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who discusses growing opposition to the proposed Israel Anti-Boycott Act in the U.S. Congress and what opponents are doing to advocate the bill's defeat. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Even as North Korea escalates its nuclear weapons and missile testing program, the nation is approaching its worst famine in 16 years. A new report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has raised alarm about a spring drought which could slash food production 30% this year. The food gap could be filled by increased imports or additional humanitarian aid, but neighbors, including South Korea, are hesitant to offer aid to Pyongyang since the government has violated international sanctions over its ongoing nuclear weapons development. Despite these sanctions, the North's economy has grown in recent years, and the hardline regime is in a better position to purchase food supplies. A state-run news outlet recently urged North Koreans to grow more food to overcome what it called barbaric international sanctions. In the mid-1990s, North Korea was devastated by a famine which killed an estimated 2 million people. At the time, children under 2 years of age became acutely malnourished. Today, Kim Jong-un's regime spends more heavily on its military than other nations. According to the State Department, nearly a quarter of the economy is dedicated to spending on the armed forces and conducting weapons research, far more than other big spenders like Oman, Saudi Arabia, and South Sudan. After months of threats to send federal officials to Chicago to suppress a wave of gun violence, the Trump administration has deployed 20 agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to combat the city's high murder rate. The Guardian newspaper reports that a federal gun task force for Chicago has been in the works since last fall. Acting U.S. Attorney Joel Levin called the new task force a multifaceted, cooperative effort between state and local officials. The new gun task force is expected to provide technical services such as a mobile ballistics lab for identifying and linking firearms to specific crimes. In 2016, more than 750 people were killed in Chicago, and during the campaign, Trump singled out the city as totally out of control. Yet, many of Chicago's community activists remain skeptical that the ATF task force can reduce the high murder rate. Instead, they say, federal funds would be better spent on reaching out to young people and supporting community programs aimed at deterring individuals from committing violence in the first place. Pastor Corey Brooks, who runs Project Hood, a nonprofit group in Chicago's South Side that offers training for youths looking for a way out of gang life, maintains that the new gun task force will incarcerate more people, but it definitely is not going to bring down the numbers of murders. A decade after the U.S. financial meltdown, California's housing prices are skyrocketing with monthly rents of $3,000 to $4,000 for a two-bedroom apartment in San Francisco ever more common. The statewide housing crisis has generated growing pressure on California's political leaders to create more affordable housing in a state where home ownership rates have fallen to a 70-year low. Housing investors have flooded into the Bay Area to purchase homes that can profitably be rented out. Airbnb, the online housing rental website, has exacerbated the problem where tenants are willing to pay ever higher rents, knowing that they can sublet their apartments to tourists willing to pay exorbitant daily rates. San Francisco has estimated that there are over 8,000 apartments in the city being listed on Airbnb, many of them without required permits and licenses. In response to spiking rents, tenants are organizing across the state to confront the powerful real estate lobby, strengthen rent control laws, and push for expanded just cause eviction regulations so that landlords cannot arbitrarily jack up rents. Activists are also lobbying local community boards to mandate that developers set aside a significant percentage of affordable housing as a condition to issue new construction permits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During the 2016 presidential election campaign, Donald Trump promised to give America's beleaguered middle-class families a substantial tax cut and said he would even consider increasing taxes on the wealthy. However, earlier this spring, the Trump economic team released an outline of its tax reform proposal, which consisted of bullet points on a single printed page. While details were scarce, analysis of the tax plan found that it would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans and the billionaire and millionaire members of Trump's cabinet. While Trump has refused to release his federal tax returns, it's a safe bet that he himself, as well as his luxury real estate development company, would be primary beneficiaries of the tax reform plan. Analysis of the Trump administration's tax plan by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found that the wealthiest 1% of households would receive 61% of all Trump tax breaks and would receive an average $145,400 in 2018 alone. In contrast, the middle 20% of taxpayers would receive about 6.2% of the cuts and an average tax cut of just $730 next year. While the richest 1% would receive tax cuts equal to 6.9% of their income in 2018, the bottom 60% of taxpayers would receive tax cuts equal to just 1.2% of their income. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, senior fellow with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who discusses his group's analysis of the Trump administration's tax reform plan and what a progressive reform plan focused on reversing growing economic inequality would look like.
Trump is answering all the easy questions about tax reform and none of the hard ones, by which I mean he's proposing to sharply reduce tax rates, especially at the top, on both the personal and the corporate side, and to repeal the estate tax, to repeal the alternative minimum tax. That's the main reason that people like President Trump pay any taxes at all. But he is almost silent on the difficult question of how to pay for these reforms. You know, in a deficit environment, everyone agrees that it's important for tax cuts not to break the bank, that they, if you're going to reduce rates, you ought to look for loopholes to close, and everyone knows we certainly have these. But especially on the corporate front, which is arguably where loophole closing is most needed at this time, there's just no detail there at all. There's very general language about taking away unwarranted loopholes, but notably, none of them are identified. So it's fair to say that we're looking at sharp reductions of the taxes that the best off Americans pay and much smaller cuts in the taxes that the rest of us pay, with the result that you're looking at a very large hole in our budget deficit of about $4.8 trillion over the next 10 years.
How much detail has been provided about their proposed tax cut policy? What do we know exactly?
We know that the tax rate on pass-through income, businesses on the individual side, will go down from the current 39.6 to 15%. A huge cut that would benefit only a small number of the very best off Americans. We know the estate tax rate would go to zero, And we know that the corporate tax rate would go as low as 15%, although Trump has backpedaled on that a little bit. But and we know as well that most itemized deductions would be repealed, leaving just charitable and mortgage. So the deduction for state and local taxes would go away. We believe personal exemptions would go away as well, the exemptions that you claim for every family member on your income taxes, and that there would be a new tax break for child care, which hasn't been very well defined, but could be pretty big. The possibly unforeseen, likely unforeseen impact of that is that larger families in the middle of the income distribution could actually see tax hikes under this swap. If you don't have, if you have a lot of kids and you're losing all your personal exemptions, this could actually mean a tax hike for you. Similarly, if you live in a state where the state and local taxes are fairly high or fairly progressive, New York, California, states like that, the loss of the itemized deduction, federal itemized deduction for state taxes, could also make you into a loser under this plan. So it manages to be a very large tax cut, trillions and trillions of dollars, while simultaneously imposing some tax hikes on people who certainly are not expecting them based on the rhetoric we've heard from the administration.
The United States, over recent, over many decades, has experienced growing income inequality. And as you look at the process of tax reform, what are some of the most essential and important things that could be done with tax reform to specifically address the goal of reversing this growing economic inequality, which certainly adversely affects the majority of people in the United States?
I think a sensible starting point, a starting observation to make about our tax system is that it taxes worth more heavily than wealth. We have a capital gains and dividends top tax rate that is about half the tax rate on wages. Rectifying that, treating all kinds of income the same, would be an important step toward a fairer tax system. It's a step that would allow for affordable tax reductions for middle and low income families. And it would just restore, I think, a little bit the public's faith that the tax system is an impartial thing, that it's not there to help the Mitt Romneys and the Donald Trumps of the world to avoid taxes. We really need a tax reform that simultaneously takes away these visible indicators of institutional inequality and, as a result, helps to knit together the public's trust in our institutions, in our government, in our leaders. As long as you have these symbols of opulence and inequality in our tax system, it's a lot to ask for people to trust that their leaders have their best interest in mind. So ending corporate tax breaks, meaningfully ending them, taking away the tax break for wealth over work, these are both changes that would benefit low and middle income families, that would get us closer to having something resembling a fairer tax system, and would help solve our budget deficits and our democratic distrust deficit as well.
That was Matthew Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Find links to more analysis on the proposed Trump tax plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 17th, the Democratic Party-controlled California legislature voted to extend the state's trend-setting cap-and-trade program until the year 2030. The measure would reduce greenhouse gas emissions over time by allowing companies to pay to pollute if they can't stay under the ever-tightening limits. While this system has proven an effective way to reduce various pollutants, it also means that the communities closest to the polluting industries pay the biggest price, which has split the environmental community. The California cap-and-trade bill was initiated by the state's Democratic governor, Jerry Brown, which drew support from some Republicans. Brown says he spoke with all the stakeholders, including industry, unions, agriculture, and progressive activists. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Masada Dizenhaus, the North American organizing director with the global climate group 350.org, based in San Diego. Here she talks about why her organization and others oppose the cap-and-trade legislation, and her view that even though California is leading the nation in many ways in responding to climate change, there's still much more that must be done.
You know, we think that the bill that passed weakens California's groundbreaking climate legislation. So this is an extension of that. And we think it makes it weaker and is a giveaway to oil companies and actually threatens the state's ability to reach its greenhouse gas reduction targets. And we also think that one of the major reasons we opposed it is we consulted with the environmental justice and frontline organizations we work with. And the bill really does nothing to alleviate the impacts that disadvantaged communities throughout the state are facing from fossil fuel pollution, and in fact takes away the ability of both the state and local air quality boards to protect those impacted communities. So that's really what our problem was. And Governor Brown did not really consult everybody on this bill. This bill is clearly the result of backroom talks with polluters instead of impacted communities. The main problem with the bill, it sets this really bad precedent where it prevents both local air quality boards and even the state's own Air Resources Board, which is the state agency that manages climate programs in California, it prevents them from putting in place greenhouse gas reduction regulations above what this bill does. It's basically a complete giveaway to oil companies because both the state air board and one of the local air boards, specifically in the Bay Area, had measures that were pending that would have required reductions in greenhouse gas pollution from refineries and other big polluters. And this bill is basically says to them, no, you can't put those in place. This bill is going to determine what's required, and no state or local air quality board can put more severe restrictions on pollution. And so the reason it's really a problem is because under cap and trade, polluters can pay for, can basically pay to pollute. And this allows them to keep doing that with impunity because it doesn't even allow the local air quality boards to say, you know what, this carbon pollution, which is both bad for the climate and bad for people's respiratory systems, you know, is bad for our community's health, and so we're going to impose this additional requirement on it. This prohibits them from doing that, and it's just a really bad precedent, and it's something that the oil industry really advocated for.
Masada Dizenhaus, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that California is one of the leading oil-producing states in the U.S. But what about gas?
Well, California is an oil-producing state. It's usually either the third or fourth, depending on the year, oil producer in the country. And we don't really produce gas except a little bit as a side product, but we do have fracking. So we frack for oil here, kind of the same way that in other parts of the country. There's fracking that's done both for oil and gas.
Governor Jerry Brown has a global reputation as Mr. Climate Change Fighter. He's been invited to speak at global forums, even though he can't officially represent the U.S. How does that comport with this series of bills he's initiated and is getting passed?
Arguably, California has the most advanced climate legislation in the country. But, you know, climate change is a massive, urgent problem, and California is just not doing enough. And so we don't want to belittle the accomplishments that California has made. It's, you know, there are some really great accomplishments, but it's just scientifically, in terms of meeting the challenges that climate change presents, it's not sufficient. And we're also concerned, honestly, about whether the climate solutions we are putting in place are working in a way to advance environmental justice. Because, as you know, communities of color, lower-income communities, are often bear the brunt of the impacts of climate change and the impacts of living next door to some of these fossil fuel extraction or refineries or, you know, some of the fossil fuel infrastructure. And so we just think, you know, there's a lot of support in California. Every time Californians are polled, they really very strongly support climate action. We think the support is there to allow the state to go even further than where it's gone. And there's a lot to address. You know, like you said, California is, you know, usually the third largest oil producer. We have fracking, and in parts of L.A., we have fracking going on right next door to people's homes or schools. And California could be out there saying, you know, we're going to stop fracking and extracting as of a particular date. We also have, you know, on the one hand, we have these ambitious targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. But at the same time, We still have a Public Utilities Commission that's approving new power plants to be built, you know, new gas-burning fire power plants. We haven't quite gotten there in California. So while we applaud the efforts that California has made, we really think that there's a much bigger distance to go on both the greenhouse gas reduction front and the environmental justice front. And we want to push the state to be as strong as it can be.
That was Masada Dizenhouse, the North American Organizing Director with the Global Climate Group 350.org. Find more analysis on California's cap-and-trade legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. U.S. 43 senators, 29 Republicans and 14 Democrats, have co-sponsored a proposed bill that would make it a felony crime for Americans to support the international boycott against Israel for that nation's decades-long illegal occupation of Palestinian lands. The penalties attached to the legislation, called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, S-720 in the U.S. Senate and H.R. 1697 in the House, would impose a minimum civil fine of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. The American Civil Liberties Union condemned the bill, stating, "The impacts of the legislation would be antithetical to free speech protections enshrined in the First Amendment." The ACLU also urged legislators to oppose the measure in the absence of significant revisions. The two primary sponsors of the bill, Senators Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, and Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, initially rejected the ACLU's criticism. But Cardin later said he was open to amending the legislation to address the group's concerns. Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who discusses growing opposition to the Israel Anti-Boycott Act and what opponents are doing to advocate the bill's defeat.
What the bill does is it extends and greatly expands the scope of a 1970s-era law that prohibits U.S. companies from complying with the Arab League boycott of Israel. And what it does is it extends the same civil and criminal penalties to corporations that adhere to this boycott of Israel by the Arab League to U.S. persons whose actions have the effect of furthering a boycott of Israel or Israeli settlements called for by an international governmental organization. So what this law would do, if it became a law, what this bill would do would basically have the potential to throw an individual in jail for up to 20 years for doing something, according to the ACLU, for posting on Facebook that I support the UN Human Rights Council compiling a database of Israeli settlement products, and I'm not going to do any personal business with these Israeli settlements because I don't agree with Israeli settlements. That's the draconian nature of this bill, and the fact that its authors have been caught trying to imprison U.S. persons for expressing a fundamentally First Amendment-protected right to freedom of speech has caused them to obfuscate the issue a lot and claim that it doesn't pertain to individuals, but in fact a plain reading of the underlying law would suggest that individuals would be caught up in this dragnet.
The primary sponsors of this legislation, Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland and Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, have pushed back against charges by the ACLU that these civil and criminal penalties violate the First Amendment of free speech here in the United States. What can you tell us about their rationale, Cardin and Portman's rationale, for disputing the notion that this is a violation of free speech?
Well, I think Senator Cardin from Maryland, who's really the lead sponsor of this bill, is quite embarrassed because he fancies himself as part of this Democratic resistance to Trump's authoritarianism, and he's been caught red-handed by the ACLU, the premier First Amendment organization in this country, trying to put forward a bill that would penalize and severely criminalize the act of boycotting Israel. And he's trying to make all kinds of obfuscations and legal arguments that the ACLU doesn't know what it's talking about. But I would much take their interpretation of the bill over Senator Cardin, who, by the way, wrote this bill in conjunction with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee and unveiled it at their annual policy conference this spring. So this bill is being put forward at the behest of Israel and its supporters in the United States, who are attempting, through various heavy-handed legislative efforts, both in Congress and at the state level, to try to quash this growing and successful global civil society movement for campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Senator Cardin has just clearly overreached, and he's clearly embarrassed by the fact that he's been called out by the ACLU on his very anti-First Amendment bill.
Josh, review for us the coalition that has been organized to oppose this anti-boycott act in the U.S. Congress. What kinds of groups have gathered together to unite to oppose this legislation?
Well, certainly this is something that our organization has viewed as a top priority since it was first introduced in March. And to be honest, it didn't get a whole lot of traction until the ACLU came out very, very forcefully several weeks ago saying that the bill was in direct violation of the First Amendment. And so since the ACLU came out with that letter, a whole host of organizations have jumped on the bandwagon in opposition to it. Move On, Credo, lots of different First Amendment rights organizations, J Street, and other organizations as well. The importance of activists attending these town hall meetings and pressing their members of Congress is that when they do so, they're finding that the crowds are with them totally. And this is having a huge demonstration effect on members of Congress who have never necessarily seen such opposition from their constituents to their policies of supporting Israel's policies of oppression toward the Palestinians.
That was Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Find more news and commentary on the Israel Anti-Boycott Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Early morning, a time of rest, quiet, and repose. On August 8th, 1978, only the early birds in search of worms were stirring. Also, cops assembled, heavily armed. They attacked the Move House in West Philadelphia's Powelton Village. Then, hundreds and perhaps thousands of shots poured into the house. How could we know the number? For before night fell, the building would be shattered, razed into the dark, wet earth. Water cannons pumped hundreds of gallons into the house, a deliberate attempt to flush Move people from their own communal home. When they emerged, to escape drowning and bullets shot into the dark basement, men, women, and children arose from the murky waters to find themselves facing dozens of cops fiendishly pointing rifles and pistols at them. Instinctively, they raised their arms to show that they weren't armed, to avoid being shot by the maddened coterie of cops. Delbert Africa pulled himself out of a basement window, his arms raised above his back and chest bare, only to be rifle-butted, slammed with a police helmet, and when he fell, pummeled, kicked repeatedly in his face and head. When he appeared in court for arraignment some hours later, his left eye looked more like a golf ball than an eyeball. Saliva ran down his chin, reflecting his broken jaw. Almost all of the men were beaten. And what of the women? They were driven to the banks of the Delaware River, where they heard cops arguing amongst themselves. One cop would say, "Let's rape them and throw them into the water." They were rerouted and driven to the nearby House of Correction, a county prison, to await trial. What happened to them on August 8th, the holistic rain of police gunfire, beatings, rape threats, and incarceration was nothing compared to what they faced in Philadelphia courtrooms, where they were denied their every right, including their alleged right of self-representation, beaten again when they refused to attend their own legal lynchings, and then the lynchpin, convictions, and common sentences before Judge Edwin Malmed of 30 to 100 years for third-degree murder? Malmed, during a phone call from me to the Frank Ford Show at WWDB FM radio, where the judge was a guest, answered the question of who killed the cop by saying, "I haven't the faintest idea." Nine people, nine men and women, nine Move members, and 30 to 100 years. Today, August 2017, marks 39 years in prison for Move members, of which seven survive. Merle and Phil Africa have returned to the source under what can only be called suspicious circumstances. Another fact, none of the imprisoned Move sisters had weapons charges. Eddie Africa was never convicted of any degree of murder. His charges? Attempted assault, I kid you not. Move members are in prison today because they were Move members, period. They're guilty of nothing except resistance to a racist, brutal, corrupt system. The same system that gave rise to mass incarceration on a scale that the world has never seen before. Their sentences are an abomination. Free Delbert, Eddie, Mike, Chuck, Janine, Janet, and Debbie Africa. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Masters in Government. In a matter of days, the White House has gone through its latest purge. Gone are stalwarts of the GOP, men like journalist Sean Spicer and former Republican National Committee Chief Reince Priebus, Trump's former press secretary and chief of staff, respectively. Spicer contorted himself like a pretzel trying to please his boss, but his efforts only led to more and more humiliation. From snap hiring of a political neophyte and outsider to be his communications chief served as the unkindest cut, sending Spicer on his way. Priebus had his share of humiliation pie as the newest hire, with Trump's tacit approval, savaged him in the media. Trump needed no help in humiliating his AG, a man who left the safe seat in the Senate to grab a ride on the Trump train. At every speech in the last few days, Trump needled Attorney General Jeff Sessions, showing a mean streak made meaner by the acquisition of imperial power. Trump, who saw his repeal and replace efforts to abolish Obamacare go down in flames, has had a presidential temper tantrum, slashing and burning all whom he deems disloyal. He, like a drunken monarch, demands loyalty from all, while he grants loyalty to none. Like the empire he represents, his office is a site of palace intrigue, of upheaval, of dysfunction, of glory days gone by, never to rise again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Children at play. First, you observe their total concentration with an intensity that is all-consuming. Second, you notice their boundless energy as they run, wrapped in a cocoon of play. What that teaches us is that young people are bundles of energy, both physical and mental. Why is this important to us? Because our studies reveal that youth are natural conductors of revolutionary energy. Indeed, their very being are suffused in a revolutionary process of transformation as they change from childhood to adulthood. Revolution bubbles in the very bones of the young. And as they change, they spark change in their environments. Indeed, they give life force to social change. In science, when molecules speed up movement, this process changes energy into heat. Similarly, when social movements agitate in static societies, they radiate excitement. They bring heat. Heat is the element that creates the conditions for change. For when we cook, we change raw materials into food we can digest. When we work out and exercise, we turn fat into muscle. And yes, when we have sex, we bring forth new life. That's cooking, ain't it? I think so, right? When we struggle, we cook up social change. If we do it hard enough, hot enough, we make revolution. Total social change can be born. The youth make revolution. They always have and always will. Before I depart, a few words from the great black revolutionary Dr. Frantz Fanon, who worked himself to death on behalf of the Algerian Revolution. Now, because I don't have the text before me, I must try to recount it from memory. He said, "Every generation must, out of relative obscurity, find their destiny and fulfill it or betray it." Dr. Frantz Fanon. So think about that. On the move. Long live John Africa. The youth make the revolution. From imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs radio program produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The show is podcast at globalresearch.ca and airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. This week, as part of our 2017 summer series, we air audio from a talk by Ava Bartlett entitled, "What Really Is Going On in Syria?" This talk was presented in Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017. It was part of a Canadian multi-city tour conducted in late 2016 and early 2017, co-sponsored by the Canadian Peace Conference and the Sirius Solidarity Movement. Winnipeg sponsors of the event included the Manitoba Peace Council, Canadian Dimension Magazine, and CKUW 95.9 FM, which hosts the Global Research NewsHour radio program. Ava Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist from Fergus, Ontario, who has visited Syria and covered the war there on six separate occasions since 2014, including 2 months in the summer of 2016 and 1 month at the end of 2016. She writes for and speaks on different media outlets, but always maintains her blog, ingaza.wordpress.com, which she started some years ago while living for a period of 3 years in Gaza. Bartlett started to receive a lot of attention on the internet after a video of her presenting at a December 9, 2016 UN press conference went viral. She exposed in a very compelling way the mainstream and even a lot of alternative media myths and lies being told about the ongoing conflict in the Western Asian country. Bartlett's first-hand reporting, like that of her colleague Vanessa Beely, challenges the narratives put forward not only by mainstream media, but also alternative outlets like Democracy Now! And human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Médecins Sans Frontières. Her journalism points to the reality that it is principally the foreign insurgents like the Al-Nusra Front and ISIS, and not the Syrian government, that is the main arbiter of violence in the country. Contrary to the insinuation from critics of being an Assad supporter, she claims to support the sovereignty of the Syrian people, which has been undermined by the U.S. and NATO, as well as the so-called rebels. The talk you are about to hear was recorded and edited by me, Michael Welch, for the Global Research NewsHour. Ava Bartlett was introduced by Liz Carlisle, a local organizer, union member, and activist, who also functioned as the moderator of the event. So here is Ava Bartlett on the Global Research NewsHour in the summer.
Eva is an independent writer and activist for human rights. She's got extensive experience in Syria and Gaza. In fact, she lived for a cumulative total of 3 years in Gaza from 2008 to 2013 and documented both the 2008, 2009, and 2012 war crimes by Israel against Gaza. She was riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals at that time, so again had a kind of firsthand and eyewitness experience that is not too common. Also, from June to August 2016, she visited Syria. She's visited Syria 6 times, in fact, I understand. Her writings can be found on her blog in Gaza. I believe that blog does include work from Gaza as well as Syria. And it's a really good place to go to find out more about Eva's observations and her perspective. And without further ado, I'll introduce Ava Bartlett. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for both the introductions, and thank you all for having this forum where I can speak and share my experiences in Syria, what Syrians have told me, what they really ask and demanded people here to at least know about outside of Syria. Before I get into it, I just want to make a few remarks. Let's see. First of all, yes, I have been to Syria 6 times. The first time was with an international peace delegation, and our interest was exclusively and solely to go to Syria to meet with Syrian people. It was only for 1 week, and it was only in the cities of Damascus, Homs, and Latakia, but it was still very informative for the majority of the 40 or 50-plus people. And I also went on one other delegation led by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and also by former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. And that was in February 2015. The other 4 visits, I've applied for a visa at the Syrian embassy in Beirut. And in 3 cases, I waited well over a month to get my visa permission, which I paid for, of course, the visa procedure. And then I paid for my own transit to Syria and travel within Syria and accommodation. So I think it's important to establish that I am self-funded and I've paid for my trips in Syria. Another note is that I'm sure you're all aware that independent media does not pay well, or pay, period. So, and this is not a solicitation for donations. I'm just making a point. I write for maybe three sites that actually pay me for my articles, and the rest of them don't. So the ones that pay are one called sutt.net, S-O-T-T.net, and it's, you know, covers a variety of issues. American Herald Tribune, which I've contributed to, and Russia Today, which I've contributed to. So on that note, I want to just show you a few things before I get into the whole thing. So Russia Today I started writing for when I was living in Gaza, and they approached me and they say, you know, we saw your blog, you're living there, we'd really like it if you could contribute opinion pieces. I stress this, opinion pieces. Has anyone heard of the op-ed section of the New York Times or any major paper? These are opinion pieces. Employees are people that write opinion pieces for New York Times, Toronto Star, wherever, are not employees of Toronto Star or New York Times. They're contributors too. So I note that from April 2013 to present day, I contributed 8 opinion pieces to RT. I also just want to make a quick note, and there's a reason I'm making these points, is because there are some articles written about me that say Bartlett writes a blog for Russian state-controlled media. They're referring, of course, to the opinion section of Russia Today. Now, the other thing I wanted to note, the other thing I want to note is this. Here are some authors who contribute to the opinion section of Russia Today. Some of these names might be familiar to you. Cynthia McKinney is one. You can see for yourself. But anyway, there's over 70 contributors. Mazi Nazimroya, who's been excellent, very detailed and articulate on Libya and other issues. And a number of other people. Sharmeen Narwani, who I highly recommend reading on Syria. William Engdahl. So you can see these are all employees of Putin. Right. I think you got the point. The other thing I just want to note is look at this at the very bottom here. The statements, views, and opinions expressed in this column are solely those of the author and do not necessarily reflect those of RT. Thus, those who contribute to RT are doing so of their own will. What I write is not censored unless it's for flow or I have some typos, which definitely occur. But they are my sentiments. And I'm making this point. I'm not at all saying I'm an expert on Syria. I would never even pretend that. But what I'm saying is I'm going to share my observations from Syria and also draw in some, you know, conclusions based on also a lot of research looking at a variety of different sites. And I would encourage you to, after my presentation, definitely don't take my word for it. Do your own research. Find your own sources. See if my stories corroborate with other authors or reports. One author I would highly recommend is Stephen Gowans. He's a Canadian. And the reason I'm mentioning him, I'll just mention in Ottawa and in Montreal, and I had the honor to have Stephen Gowans, Michelle Chosudovsky, and also Eve Engler speak prior to my part of the panel. And with regard to both Gowans and Chosudovsky, they gave, you know, a terribly important context into what was happening in Syria prior to 2011, or also the NATO or the U.S., not just U.S., the NATO alliance waging wars on sovereign nations, and Syria not being the first, and also reminding of some of the media lies that we've heard before, whether it was incubator babies or Gaddafi's forces raping women, being on Viagra and raping women, or weapons of mass destruction, none of which any of these allegations ever had any substance behind them. And it does really surprise me when it comes to Syria, so many people somehow have forgotten the lessons we've learned from these prior wars of aggression on sovereign nations. Tim Anderson is another author I would like to recommend before I get into it. And just to quote him, he said, many Western audiences, liberals and leftists, as well as the more conservative, seem to like the idea of their own role as saviors of a foreign people, speaking out strongly about a country of which they knew very little, but joining what seemed to be a good fight against this new dictator. With a mission and their proud self-image, Western audiences apparently forgot the lies of previous wars and of their own colonial legacies. And I read that. He goes on, and I'd like to also suggest, you know, if you're interested in some very genuine research, Tim Anderson has a book called The Dirty War on Syria. And in my opinion, it's an invaluable resource. I'd like to start with a short clip, and then I will explain it. So that's my own little editing job, taking a clip from the BBC, who has an expert of sorts asserting certain things about this video. And the video is called Syrian Hero Boy. It purported to show a little boy rescuing his sister from fire, which could have been coming from the Syrian army or from rebel militants. And so the expert says, you know, the video, we can't really say for sure whether it's accurate or not, but we can definitely say it's in Syria. And we can definitely say so because it has the colors of the Syrian army flag, how she stated. It's actually the flag of the country of Syria, painted on a barrel. So this is a still from that video. Please note the color scheme. And these are barrels that I took a photo of in Aleppo. Do you notice any differences? So based on these barrels with a similar color scheme, but a totally inaccurate one, this expert said we can definitely say it's in Syria and we can definitely say it's in a regime area. The video was produced by Norwegians and filmed in Malta. So just bear in mind, this is the BBC, and this is not the first time they've been wrong or they've outright lied. She must have been mistaken. It happens. But, you know, for an expert to definitely say about the flag and then getting even that wrong is very telling. So, again, just to stress, you know, really question your sources. The other one I'd like to show you briefly. This is one example where one would have to be extremely skeptical about this video, because had you not seen the frozen motion prior to the action beginning, and had you not seen this man posing with his rescuers after on, you know, crushed legs, you might actually believe this was a rescue scene. And so the point I'm trying to make is, whereas some of the videos might be true, some of them might be staged. And this shows how clearly possible it is to stage a very compelling rescue video. And the White Helmets, because I'll probably forget later to tell you, they are basically a group that purports to be neutral, unbiased, Syrian rescuers, grassroots people, doing their bit for the community, saving civilians from regime or Russian bombings. This is basically paraphrasing. This is what their story is. And they've saved anywhere from 60 to 80,000. I think 80,000 was the latest figure I've seen in Syria. In reality, they were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer, James Le Mercier. They've been funded by the West with well over $100 million, so they're not exactly grassroots. They work exclusively in militant areas and more frequently in al-Qaeda, al-Nusra areas. And not all, but some of them definitely do participate in holding flags or weapons in alliance with al-Qaeda or other mercenaries in Syria. And you can see in this image, whereas you could say, well, that was before, and then they became rescuers. In this image, you actually see a White Helmet volunteer with al-Qaeda. So these people are not neutral, and they have actually participated in collecting the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers and gloating about it. They've also been on the scene at execution assassination sites. So this is from a video. Somebody compiled this collage showing within seconds after the man in the black jumpsuit was assassinated, White Helmets appeared. So again, implying not exactly neutral. Yet they're one of the main sources that we've been told by corporate media, especially by Channel 4, a UK channel, which incidentally wrote the piece about me saying I was a blogger for RT, they are one of the main sources that our media has been using. And Democracy Now!, which purports to be independent media, has been shameful on Syria just as they were with Libya. And they, you know, I gave up following them years ago because it just made me sick to my stomach. But I am aware that they've largely, by accounts of other people who've been more religious in following them, they've largely only had one side of the story, and they've actually hosted the filmmaker who made the documentary on the White Helmets. And the filmmakers themselves never even went to Syria. Nonetheless, Democracy Now! Has chosen to support that avenue. And another two sources that our media tells us, are giving us the facts, are the Aleppo Media Center. You'll see the AMC logo on many of the films and photos coming out of Aleppo or in the past. They are also funded by the West, which makes them not an impartial source. And the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, SOHR, this observatory is literally one man in the UK who flies an FSA flag on his website, who is vocally anti-government, So again, not an impartial source. And he himself relies on unnamed activists, the White Helmets, and characters who themselves are not impartial. These are the main sources, some of the main sources, that we've been getting, Western media has been getting their facts from regarding Syria. One last note before I get into it. In April of 2016, there were, in that month, there were a series of, it was like a flurry of media reporting on Aleppo, on hospitals being targeted and destroyed, on last doctors. There was a really concerted effort to move people to be compelled to support something like a no-fly zone, which they rebranded as a safe zone, thinking that sounded nicer. But in effect, it means destroying the country and allowing, you know, imposing a puppet government, which is what they did in Libya. Médecins Sans Frontières, you can see this tweet where they said a hospital, which was the Quds Hospital in the El Sukri district of Aleppo, was destroyed. In their actual report, they said it was hit, reducing it to rubble, so destroyed. This is the Al-Quds Hospital, still standing. A colleague of mine was in Aleppo in December, and she took this photo. And she also was able to enter the hospital and find paperwork showing it was operational as of July 2016, a few months after the April allegations. So again, this story was very compelling. People were outraged. The Syrian government or the Russian airplanes bombed this hospital. That was the story, and people were outraged and compelled to do something. The story was false. The hospital was not destroyed. But we never get these fact checks. So it's rather ironic that there's all this focus on fact checking when the main perpetrators of lies have been the fact checkers themselves. So on to Aleppo. When I was in Syria in summer 2016, I had been to many areas of Syria. I'd been to Homs a number of times. I'd been to Homs in June 2014, about one month, I think it was, after militants who had been occupying the old city of Homs were taken out in a deal similar to what's happened in Aleppo recently. They were bussed out, and they were given safe passage. Now, I just want you to really focus on this. They were given safe passage from the area they were occupying, essentially holding the people that remained in that area hostage, just like with Aleppo. They were given safe passage to, it might have been Idlib, some other part of Syria, where they joined other militants. I cannot imagine a context in America, in Canada, in which terrorists occupying one area of a city and literally terrorizing the public and killing the public would be given safe passage to somewhere else to terrorize the public elsewhere. I can't see that happening. In any case, as I was going to say, I'd been to many areas of Syria, but I hadn't been to Aleppo. And given that there were so many confusing stories coming out of Aleppo, I really wanted to go and see for myself what people were saying there. So this is the main, well, not the main road. This is the alternative road to Aleppo. It's called the Kanasser Highway. The main road goes through areas of Syria which are occupied by militant factions, so it's been off limits for years. This particular highway is not very wide. At this point, I believe it was, ISIS was less than 10 kilometers off to, it would have been the east. And at night, they come onto the highway and lay landmines, and they also wage attacks just randomly. You can see, as you're driving along, you can see the shells of different vehicles, trucks, on the sides, either side of the road, from attacks from ISIS, and I believe also in the past from al-Nusra. So it is a very dangerous highway, as was the sole road at that time leading into Aleppo, called the Ramusi Road. And that road was dangerous because militants in a district called Sheikh Said, just some hundreds of meters to the northeast of Ramusi, would snipe at people on the road, and they'd also shell the road. And bearing in mind that, yes, there are military in that area, but it was also the only transit point for civilians exiting and entering Aleppo, as well as transport trucks bringing in the vital goods that they needed. So there were earthen embankments and sniper shields. But that said, it didn't prevent these militants from sniping at people and killing people on this road. Another important point about Ramusi Road is that when, on many occasions, it was cut off, that meant the people in greater Aleppo were completely besieged. And they had no means of getting vital supplies into Aleppo until that road was resecured. And I mention that because what I found when I went to Aleppo basically reaffirmed what I felt I thought I would find, and that was that when Western media was reporting about Aleppo, they meant East Aleppo. They didn't mean all of Aleppo. They meant one segment of Aleppo, and they meant the area that was occupied by militants or rebels, whatever you want to call them, And they meant only to focus on those areas and totally ignore the 1.5 million people in the rest of Aleppo and ignore their suffering. They'd been suffering since mid-2012, not only from the difficulty getting in and out of the city and the periodic sieges depriving them of food supplies, but also a want of electricity and water because both the water pumping station and the power plant were in areas controlled by militants. So for years they've survived off of wells, over 300 wells that the government and volunteer associations dug, and buying electricity from generators. And, of course, not everybody could afford to do that. And they would literally buy it by the ampere. So maybe one ampere could power a couple of bulbs, two amperes could power a couple of light bulbs and a small fridge, etc. And a lot of people couldn't afford that because the combination of now 6 years of war on Syria has devastated the economy, and the Western sanctions on the country have devastated the economy. So a lot of people simply couldn't afford to buy electricity. I got a taste of that when I returned to Aleppo in August and stayed in a district called Azizia. And the building I was in had been completely, all the residents had left and had immigrated to Europe or elsewhere because they couldn't take it anymore, living under the bombs of these rebel factions. And also, when I was there, that building had no electricity, no water. And as I looked out onto the block, the whole block was dark except for about 7 apartments, which had very dim light. So essentially, all the people that remained in that block couldn't afford to buy electricity. And this is an important factor. Obviously, you can imagine a life without electricity and water for years. So back to the issue of hospitals. One of the first things I did was to go to the Aleppo Medical Association because I kept seeing all these reports in Western media about last doctors and last pediatricians. And the Aleppo Medical Association has registered and active 4,160 doctors. And then I asked them to break down, you know, the specialist. And so the director, Dr. Zahra Batal, gave me a list. And so I tallied up the list of specialists, so again, pediatricians and other specialists. And there were around 800 specialists. And this is important because, again, when Western media or corporate media was talking about Aleppo, they were talking about East Aleppo, and they were saying last pediatrician, last doctor, anyway, last specialist. And that wasn't the case. The other thing about the situation for doctors and hospitals in Aleppo was that hospitals in Greater Aleppo have been attacked. And this is, to my knowledge, not reported in corporate media. This is one example. The Dabit Hospital in May 2013, it wasn't directly attacked the first time. The second time, a week later, it was, with a mortar landing on the roof. The first time, a rocket or a missile of some sort fired by militant-occupied areas landed on parked cars outside the hospital, exploding the cars, internally gutting the hospital, and killing 3 women inside. And with all the concern about hospitals that we heard, if you're following Syria, you would have thought that these kind of scenes would have been something we would have seen in New York Times. So you can see it was an immense explosion or series of explosions, depending on how many cars exploded. And again, a maternity hospital. That's just one example. A more notable example was al-Nusra truck bombing the Kindi Hospital, which was a massive cancer research hospital. And literally, there was no condemnation that I'm aware of from the West. I actually interviewed the director, the former director of the Kindi Hospital, Dr. Ibrahim Hadid, and he said when it was occupied by al-Nusra, he tried to contact the WHO and other bodies that would be concerned about, you know, healthcare in Syria, and was met with apathy and no condemnation. And he said it was the same when the hospital was destroyed, no condemnation. But another important point about the Kindi Hospital was that some months ago, I saw a photo of this destroyed Kindi Hospital being shown and being claimed to be in East Aleppo and being claimed that it was bombed or destroyed by the Russians or the Syrians. And this was something that occurred in 2013 by al-Nusra. So again, the media doesn't really expect us always to check our sources or check the truth. So I interviewed a man named Dr. Nabil Antaki. He is on Facebook. Also, if you Google his name, Antaki, A-N-T-A-K-I, you can find a number of independent sources that have interviewed him. He's interesting. He's a very straightforward guy. He's not necessarily completely supportive of the government, but anyway, he was pointing out the greater issues that people are facing. And he said since July 2012,
The main area of Aleppo receives everyday mortars, bombs, and gas canisters. And I don't know if you noticed the gas canister photo I had at the beginning. They're basically cooking gas canisters that have been fitted with explosives and fired on a near daily basis, not only on Aleppo, but outskirts and other areas of Syria. He said, here you have human damage more than there, meaning East Aleppo, which may or may not be true. I'll get to that. But the important point he makes is here you have less physical destruction because the bombs they're receiving are of a small size but raining on a constant basis. So a mortar might make, according to him, a hole the size of a window but also kill five people at once. And if you imagine that on one particular day you have over 100 mortars or a combination of mortars and missiles and other explosives, the human damage was immense. In fact, the head of forensics that I met with in November on my third visit to Aleppo, said in the past 4+ years, 11,000 civilians, not including military personnel, just civilians in Aleppo, have been killed by these different mortar, gas canister, explosive bullets, and sniping attacks by militant factions. So that's a significant number, 11,000 civilians, yet not one that I've ever heard in Western media, because it doesn't support their narrative. Dr. Zahir Buttel, I was asking him just to give me some statistics. So he was referring to April, since that was a month that was heavily reported on, last doctors, last hospitals. And he said from April 23rd to 30th, there were 120 Aleppo residents killed and over 800 wounded by these different militant attacks. And later, when I was asking him some questions through message, he said between July 31st and August 15, another 143 civilians were killed, including 23 women and 54 children. So again, these are statistics, but it's to say the people were suffering on a daily basis from the combination of want of electricity, water, and terrorist attacks. And if you go there and you talk with them, they're very clear about it. They do call them terrorists. Even Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Hawaiian congresswoman, she recently went to Syria and she made it to Aleppo and she talked with people and she came back saying what I'm saying. And she said, if you talk to Syrian people, they might call them rebels every now and then, but they definitely also say they're terrorists because these are acts of terrorism. Just on a side note, in terms of the notion of a revolution, which we can get into also in Q&A, just ask yourselves what kind of revolution consistently targets civilians. For example, this is a public park, the main public park in Aleppo. And I went there because in July there had been a rather nasty attack which left at least two women and a child dead as they sat on a park bench on a Friday afternoon. The number was much higher, but with regard to this one image, it is very graphic, I will warn you. It was on a bench like this Friday afternoon in July, and these women and at least one child you can see in the photo were killed when a rebel fired some sort of rocket or missile into the park. And in my belief, this is not accidental. The targeting of public places is not accidental. It's what they've been doing throughout Syria. And yet, little to no condemnation from Western leadership and corporate media.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour on University of Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and podcast at globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our 2017 summer series, we're airing a talk by independent journalist Ava Bartlett on what is really going on in Syria. The talk was presented at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017, roughly 2 months after her last visit to the country. The Global Research News Hour recorded the talk. Here is more from that discussion.
On November 3rd, I was there with a delegation of Western journalists, and on that day, a barrage of Grad missiles and then other mortars, gas canister bombs, and explosive bullets and snipings occurred throughout the day. By the end of the day, there were 18 killed and over 200 injured. And we were at the main hospital, Al Razi, and also at the morgue behind. So this is just a short compilation of some of the things we were seeing there. So at the end of the clip, there's a man speaking. He's from Western Syria, Jizr al-Shughur, and he's talking about the loved ones, his mother and other loved ones that have died in attacks. And he does specifically say Irhabiyin terrorists. And he says that we want the army to finish them off. This is a theme that I've heard from many Syrians anguished. You know, they've been suffering terrorism, and they say, just finish them off, just end our suffering. It doesn't mean that I agree with, you know, bombing entire areas and killing civilians, but I don't condemn this man. He's basically just in anguish, and he's saying, we want an end to our terrorism. And yet, as Tim Anderson pointed out, the government has, you know, contrary to certain media reports and contrary to human rights groups like MSF or Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, the latter two of which are tied very deeply to the State Department and receive funding from the U.S. government, hardly impartial, the army has been waging as strategic as possible operations to target the terrorist, and yes, civilians are being killed as well. But it's not policy to just go in and flatten out an entire area like the Israelis did in Shijai in Gaza in 2014. And in fact, speaking of Shijai, the head of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, tweeted video footage from Shijai and said, this is Aleppo under Assad's bombs. So this is, again, a source that we're told is going to give us credible reporting and on Syria. And he himself has tweeted many, many inaccurate things about Syria and seems to have a vested interest in regime change there. This is one of 16 Aleppo University residences which are housing internally displaced Syrians from eastern Aleppo and other areas occupied by militants or where there's fighting between the militants and the army. And for years, they've been housing. The numbers are somewhere between 10 and 15,000. And that's my estimate because we counted the number of rooms on each floor, estimated the number of people in each family. And the number is somewhere between 10 and 15,000, just in these residences alone. I think it's notable because of these people who fled the militants or the fighting, they fled to safety, what they thought was safety. They've been living in uncomfortable circumstances, very crowded. And even then, this building was attacked 2 or 3 days prior to me visiting there, which is another reason I wanted to visit, to hear what had happened. And a rocket of some sort was fired at, you can see in the upper right-hand corner, at this room, and 4 people from one family were killed. But the issue of internal refugees is, I think, very important and overlooked in the media. There's a lot of talk about external refugees, and there should be. But the issue of somewhere between 7 or 8 million internal refugees is completely overlooked, unless I've been missing something in the corporate media. And it is important because these people have fled areas where there's fighting, where there are militants present, and they've gone to government areas. And if the narrative that people are fleeing the government is true, then why do they run into the hands of the government knowing that they're going to be massacred by the government? This is, again, not to say that civilians aren't being killed in Syria, but you have to think in the context of a war, civilians will die, and that Syria is fighting terrorism. And if we do not acknowledge this is terrorism, when we have al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, when we have ISIS, of course, when we have Nuruddin al-Zinki, which gleefully beheaded a 12 or 13-year-old Palestinian child, took a video of themselves doing so and took selfies of themselves doing so and are still dubbed moderates. When we have Ahrar al-Sham, which are dubbed moderates, but in U.S.-owned internal documents, Congressional Research Service documents, they're dubbed as terrorists. In any case, when you have militants or terrorist mercenaries that have flooded into Syria, largely through Turkey, through the open border and thanks to Erdogan, flooding Syria in the name of waging jihad for Palestine, some of them actually are a small percentage, or overthrowing the government. I lost my train of thought. Anyway, the whole point is that these are acts of terrorism. And I've forgotten your name, who introduced me and was speaking about Yemen and their legitimate right to resist a blockade. Syria is a sovereign country and has a legitimate right to resist terrorism. This is another image from Aleppo. This was from Castella Road. And Castella Road is one of 8 humanitarian corridors that were opened in the hopes of allowing civilians to leave areas where militants were. On November 4th, this delegation of journalists that I joined to go to Aleppo on that occasion, we went to 2 crossings, one of them being Castella Road, and we were there for a couple of hours. And during the time we were there, at the end, before leaving, there were 2 shells fired on the crossing from an area occupied by militants. And this is not the first time they've attacked crossings. In late October, a friend of mine, a British man married to a Syrian living in Damascus but also working on trying to report truth from Syria, he was at another crossing, Bustan al-Qasr, I think it was around October 20th, there a couple days before or after, And he said from the morning till evening, that crossing was shelled by militants who clearly didn't want people to have the option of leaving East Aleppo to government-secured Aleppo. On a side note, this man, he, his wife and children, and about 40 other Syrians in late October did flee East Aleppo. He was from a district called Al-Halaq, which was north of an area called Bustan al-Pasha. And he said they took advantage of a time when there was fighting between the government and militants or rebels in that area. And he made the point, we tried to leave before. He and his family tried to leave twice before and were prevented by the militants who kept them there, violently prevented. He was arrested the first time he tried and told, if you do this again, we're going to do worse to you. I interviewed one other family from Tariq al-Bab, and they had tried four times prior to flee and were also prevented. And this is notable. There are many testimonies. Yes, you might need to look at Russia Today or Sputnik or independents like Vanessa Bealey on 21st Century Wire or Reverend Andrew Ashdown or Jan Oberg, who went to Aleppo in December when it was being liberated. There are many people who have collected similar testimonies, and more recently, and from liberated areas of Aleppo, where people said, we were being held hostage. That's not to say every single person, but a great number of people were trying to leave and could not leave. And the logical reason being, if the civilians were taken out of these areas, then it's a lot easier for the Syrian army and allies to wage attacks on terrorists. If the civilians are there, it's more difficult because to avoid loss of life. He said some other interesting things about life there. He said terrorists or militants occupied hospitals and schools and made them into headquarters. He saw militant factions coming out with their hell cannons, which were these large cannons used to fire the cooking gas canister bombs onto Aleppo, and then saw them scurry below ground into bunkers, meaning that when whether it was the Russians or the Syrian government airstrike or try to bomb areas where there are militants, it is difficult because they're underground. And that would explain a lot of the physical destruction you'll see in areas like East Aleppo or Homs prior. And none of that context is really given in corporate media. They just talk about bombing with no context as to what's being targeted. The family, this one I said, were from Tariq al-Bab, and I did ask people I met in Aleppo whether they'd heard of the White Helmets or also Syrian Civil Defense as they go by. And most people I met had not, including people in the medical profession. And this family from Tariq al-Bab said they had not. And yet this is a photo also purporting to be Tariq al-Bab. So it's probably a large district. It is feasible that the family just never encountered them. It's also feasible that maybe they're not as legendary as they make themselves out to be, the White Helmets. A woman I encountered on the campus of these of Aleppo University, this is not staged. She basically came up to me, was happy to see a foreigner. I should rephrase that, happy to see a foreigner that was not holding a weapon. And she started speaking to me in very good English. So I said, can I film you so that people outside of Syria can hear what you have to say? So she spoke from the heart. And I think her message saying, you know, she recognizes that, of course, not every militant is foreigner, but a large number of them are foreigners. And there is a foreign agenda to destabilize Syria, to push Syrians out of Syria, for example, especially Christians. I don't know if you're aware, but in the very early protests, amongst the chants for freedom and democracy were also chants to kill Alawis and drive Christians out of Syria. And this was something that was heard throughout Syria. And I've had numerous accounts, whether it was people I met in Latakia in April 2014, people I met on repeated trips to Homs, people I met in Damascus, in Malula, all over. In Malula, there weren't protests, but they certainly suffered sectarianism. And I'd like to actually just briefly touch on Malula. Malula is an ancient Christian village, Aramaic. It's one of the oldest, apparently, in history. A beautiful village nestled in the cliffs, at the base of the cliffs. And it was occupied in, I believe it was September 2013, not only by al-Nusra, but also by the Free Syrian Army. And it was occupied for about 8 months. There were skirmishes back and forth, but it was fully occupied, and it wasn't liberated till April 2014. And I visited there in June 2014, and then again this past summer. And when I visited in June, I saw a lot of the destruction of these historic churches and monasteries. What couldn't be thieved or shot down was vandalized in other ways. Material icons were stabbed, were torn apart. It was a deliberate attack on the Christians there. But in the visit in the summer, I spoke with a woman named Antoinette Talib. And her brother, uncle, and cousin were assassinated because they refused to convert to Islam. And I just want to specify, I don't believe that these al-Nusra, ISIS, or other Wahhabi or Muslim Brotherhood are acting upon the tenets of Islam. I believe they have extremist ideologies. Anyway, these people were told to convert. They said, no, we were born Christian, we'll die Christian, and they did die Christian. They were assassinated. Again, this was 2014. These were the rebels bringing democracy and freedom to Syria. If you saw any images coming out of Aleppo in December when it was being liberated, depending on which media you were looking at, you were either seeing mass groups of people basically cheering and waving Syrian flags and saying, thank God, the reign of terror is over, essentially. Or if you were watching corporate media, you were seeing scenes where people were saying Aleppo has fallen and totally ignoring the suffering they'd been enduring for years. And corporate media did have access to Aleppo. When I was there in July, Robert Fisk was there. He's been pretty good on reporting fairly truthfully. When I was there in November, CBC was there. There was a group of three or so CBC reporters. I've been quite busy since, so I don't know how they portrayed things, but I suspect it was the opposite of truth. Channel 4 was there, and I'm aware that even Vice News, which is not really known for being impartial reporting, it's one of the more sleazy sites, they have been in Aleppo. So just to say, this whole notion that they couldn't report the truth because they couldn't get there is patently false. Another point I want to make very quickly. You can see there's a Reverend Ibrahim Nasir. He's a Presbyterian priest. And then three Sunni leaders. Aleppo is predominantly Sunni city. In our media, we're told what's happening in Syria is a Sunni uprising against Alawis and other kind of sectarian language. In my experiences, and this is corroborated by other visitors to Syria, it's a very secular country. And Stephen Gowans writes extensively about how how the Syrian secularity has been, stable of society there. But when I've been there and spoken with people, they do not identify as their faith. They identify as Syrians, and it's very difficult to get them to say what faith they are because it's their business. So they're not in the business of chastising one another based on their faith. To the contrary, they actually share one another's, this is generalizing, but it's what I've seen throughout Syria and being told, they share one another's faiths, and there's intermarrying. I have a couple of friends, one is Sunni, one is Shia, they've married. That's one example, of course, and I encourage you to look for more other examples because there are many. But in this instance, Reverend Ibrahim said his church was destroyed. I forget what year. It was bombed by terrorists, intentionally destroying it. It was in the old city of Aleppo. He said right after it was destroyed, Syria's Grand Mufti, so the highest religious leader for Muslims in Syria, called him and said, don't worry, Reverend Ibrahim will rebuild the church. And he also this is with the delegation of foreign journalists, and we met with him and these three Sunni leaders. The one looking pretty snazzy in a suit was from East Aleppo, and he said he was driven out of the area by militants who put him on a death list because from his mosque there were no sectarian protests emanating. He didn't buy into the revolution, and he certainly didn't buy into sectarianism. And so to punish him, the militants either wanted him to conform and start, having these sectarian protests or kill him. So what I actually just wanted to show you before wrapping up, there is a priest named Father Daniel, and he's been in a monastery. Now, I wish I had the screenshots because I can't remember the name of the monastery, but I can certainly provide it to you. And he basically said the same thing as Father Franz van der Loot, who was a priest that was in Old Homs, who was assassinated in April 2014 by militants. And both of them said from the beginning they saw protesters who had arms and that were firing upon security forces. These are priests. I don't know about Father Daniel, but I know Father Franz wasn't a government supporter. He was a priest living there for decades, and he was just reporting and writing about what he was seeing in Homs. And he was assassinated eventually. So there are many accounts. Again, when I've been there and talked with people, I've met many Syrians who've said, when the protest began, we were optimistic because we want political change. But very quickly, we saw that there were armed segments within the protesters. And on my last visit, I interviewed somebody who was a soldier stationed in Dara, which is said to be the birthplace of the revolution. And he himself came under fire by people who were armed in the protests, killing the police and soldiers who were unarmed, only with batons. This runs, of course, in contrast to the Western narrative on Syria. I refer you humbly to an article I wrote, mainly just because I do cite a lot of very credible sources in the article. It's on Dissident Voice. I called it Deconstructing the NATO Narrative on Syria. I looked at some of the key myths or the key things we've been told about Syria. And then I, whether it was support for the government or the nonviolent protests. And then I linked to people who've done really important research and writings on it. One I would really highly recommend is Sharmeen Narwani. Now, again, she has contributed to RT, but she's also written for the Huffington Post, so, you know, you can argue it either way. She wrote this excellent article, Syria, the Hidden Massacre, and it should be plural because she wrote about a number of massacres that occurred in the early months by people who were clearly armed. There was the case of, I think his name was Ali Hashim, Ali Hashim maybe? He was an Al Jazeera reporter who resigned when Al Jazeera wouldn't run the footage he had taken showing militants entering Syria from Lebanon in May 2011. This was at a time when, again, the narrative was unarmed protesters, and it was clearly showing that these people were being sent into Syria as fighters. And he was told to forget that he'd seen any armed men. And there are many cases of journalists, including more journalists in Al Jazeera, resigning due to what they saw were media lies about Syria. I guess what I'd like to leave you with, there's a lot we can say, but I know you have some questions. I would recommend some writings like Seymour Hersh, who can no longer, to my knowledge, be published in America. He's published in the London Review of Books. He's done excellent investigative journalism, whether it's about the chemical weapons allegations. He's traced, you know, the sarin back to the so-called rebels and, you know, looked at who was providing the sarin gas to the rebels. Tim Anderson, as I mentioned, Sharmeen Narwani, and other people of 21st Century Wire who've either gone to Syria or extensively researched. I look at a variety of sources, and whether I look at Sputnik or RT, I always corroborate it with other sources because I want to be sure that what I'm seeing has a substance to it. And I'd encourage you to do that with what I've talked about. I didn't talk about how I got into this all, and I won't dwell too long on it, but basically I got into writing from Palestine out of genuine interest in seeing what the people were suffering under Israeli occupation and attacks, and I started a simple blog called In Gaza, because for me the point was to report on what I was seeing, not about myself, and over time, I started, you can see some of the places I write for. There's a long list, including Russia Today, but also Mint Press News and a number of others. And when things started in Syria, I fully admit I knew nothing about Syria, and I still have a lot to learn, but I suspected what I was seeing on Al Jazeera, which is what a lot of people in Gaza do watch, by the way, which is Qatari-owned. So if we're going to talk about state-funded, you have to know the source behind the Al Jazeera propaganda. I started feeling like what I was seeing wasn't accurate. It seems strange. And I started asking people whose opinions I respected and then doing my own research. And as the years passed, finally felt I was informed enough to actually go to Syria and then talk with Syrians. And then that's kind of been the evolution. My sole interest is in respecting the people of Syria, their sovereign right to fight terrorism and to get peace again. I think many people aren't aware there have been many initiatives. You know, in addition to these humanitarian corridors, which some would argue, well, that's just stage, you know, it's just to make it seem like the government wants to find peace. There are reconciliation efforts that nobody speaks about, giving Syrian fighters the chance to lay down their weapons, be completely pardoned, rejoin society. And there are many Syrians that, for whatever reason, who took up arms in the beginning, regret their choice and want to find a way out. There are also Syrians, I'm told, and again, please corroborate this, that were coerced by militant factions to take up weapons and fight, or else their families, for example, might be killed or something horrible like that. I'd like to just share one more example before closing. There was a sheikh, a leader of a large tribe in eastern Syrian Deir ez-Zor, Sheikh Nawaf al-Bashir, who defected or fled from Syria in, I don't know, 2011 or 12, but pretty early on. He's recently returned to Syria. When he was away in Turkey, and I'm not sure where else, he said some pretty bad things about Syria, about the government, about what was happening. And certainly you would expect that he would not be welcomed, because this is also the other line, is that dissenters can't be in Syria. There is an unarmed political opposition in Syria with a variety of different backgrounds, whether communist, feminist, Kurdish, or other parties. But this man who said some, you know, things that perhaps if he were in America and did that and then returned, he might be thrown in jail. He's returned to Syria. He actually gave a speech saying he regrets his ways, he made the wrong decision, and he's now back in Syria. And he's not, to my knowledge, in prison. So I think it's important to recognize there are internal opposition members, but the opposition the West has been supporting are Saudi-backed. One is the brother of Zahran Alush, who is known for putting civilians in cages and using them as human shields. And others adhere to a very extremist Wahhabi ideology. And again, in terms of bringing Syria freedom and democracy, just look at the militants that were in Aleppo. Look at the photos of how women were being treated in Aleppo. Testimonies of women being saying they were being forced to marry militants and, you know, awful things happening to them. And look at Syria prior to 2011. And really, most Syrians I've met had said, we just want Syria to go back to how it was before. We had stability. Of course, they have free education and health care. It wasn't a perfect country. They want political changes. But certainly, the options that have been presented to them by the West, determining for them who will lead their country, these options have not been fair or certainly not been democratic and given them any freedom. And finally, just consider who the West's allies are in this war on Syria. Saudi Arabia certainly can't be said, although it holds a position in the United Nations, bizarrely, as on the Human Rights Council, it can't be said to have a good record on human rights. And yet that's one of our Canada and America's closest allies, Qatar, Turkey. Clearly, I would encourage you to read the writings of Michelle Trzodowski, Tim Anderson, who provide a lot more context into how this came about. But clearly, in my opinion, and that of many others, this is not about giving peace to Syria or giving people democracy and freedom. So thank you very much. There might be an announcement, or else it's question and answers.
That was Canadian journalist Ava Bartlett presenting at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on February 2, 2017, on her reporting in Syria. The talk was followed by a brief question and answer period.
There are many instances of massacres committed by whether it was the Free Syrian Army, Ahrar al-Sham, or other moderates. Uncritical support. Again, I stated very clearly I'm against a premeditated war of which there is ample documentation. I would highly recommend people, if they don't want to buy The Dirty War on Syria, which is available on globalresearch.ca, you can find a lot of Tim Anderson's writings on global research. He's one person, but what he writes corroborates what I've heard in person by Syrians in Syria. And again, some of the other authors I've mentioned. In my humble opinion, Syrians in Syria do have grievances against the government, and there are issues of torture, and there are issues of it being very authoritarian, but there are other contextual issues that some people don't seem to recognize or address. On that note, I would recommend highly people take a read of Stephen Gowan's this article, The Revolutionary Distemper That Wasn't. It's a bit long, it's very detailed, very well documented. It gives the context, which was not given in your question, and also which is not given in the corporate media. Russian army involvement. The Russians were invited to fight terrorism in Syria in, I believe it was late September 2015, and they have been enabling the Syrian army and allies to take back strategic areas, including the historic area of Palmyra, which was occupied by ISIS. The U.S. Coalition, which is supposedly fighting ISIS, enabled ISIS trucks to cross hundreds of miles of open desert to take Palmyra. It kind of baffles the mind to think that with all their high-tech technology, they somehow missed a convoy of ISIS SUVs or Ford pickup trucks or whatever they were barreling through the desert and didn't stop them. The U.S.-led coalition attacked a Syrian army position in Deir ez-Zor on September 17th, killing at least 80 Syrian soldiers, could be over 100. I've heard different estimates. In an attack that was not just one attack, but a prolonged attack lasting nearly 1 hour, they had been surveying the area. They knew it was a Syrian army position. They attacked it nonetheless, attacking, including retreating Syrian army soldiers, and immediately following, ISIS took over that position. So in terms of the Russian involvement, it was invited by the government. The U.S. coalition was not invited. Their presence there is illegal, and they've repeatedly attacked infrastructure, like, for example, bridges in Deir ez-Zor, and they've committed massacres of their own right against civilians in Syria. Militants versus rebels, it's my attempt to find, I hate the word moderate, middle ground between saying terrorist, which is what most Syrians I've met call them, but when you say that here, you know, it has an impact on a Western audience and people think it's not credible. However, I refuse to use rebels because the acts that they are committing are not acts that true rebels would do, unless I'm continually using quotation marks when I say rebels. So the middle ground I've been using is militants, but that's to answer your question. It doesn't really necessarily imply the organizational structure. It's just trying to find a middle ground. Premeditated war, I was trying to pull it up, but for some reason it wouldn't load. However, there is the Project for New American Century document, which does outline... It does outline Western aspirations in the Middle East. And as we were talking about this afternoon, you have the famous General Wesley Clark statement saying... The Pentagon had informed him, you know, high ups in the Pentagon had informed him, this is back in 2004 or somewhere around there, that the U.S. was going to wage war on seven countries, and including Syria, Yemen, Libya, et cetera. So there's much documentation. Even the Oded Yenem plan, the Greater Israel Project, is very relevant to this situation. And as far as the Arab League, I can't really speak much to it. I would recommend Charmaine Narwani because I'm pretty sure she's written something about the role of the Arab League. I would say something about the role of the UN, and that's been largely to obfuscate the realities. For example, the UN does have observer forces in the occupied Syrian Golan who have observed and documented militants interacting with Israeli army, Israeli soldiers. They've documented it and they've presented this at the UN to deaf ears. You would think the fact that Israel is not only dealing with militants in occupied Syrian Golan, but also treating them in their hospitals would be a point that would come up more and more in the United Nations. But it's been a player in the role, in the game of you know, confusing people and obfuscating truth on Syria.
You just heard audio from a talk by Ava Bartlett on what is really going on in Syria. Since Bartlett's visit to Winnipeg, Syrian forces, with the assistance of the Russian Air Force, have made substantial advances against the opposition forces and have liberated a number of other terrorist-controlled cities inside Syria. The U.S. has agreed to arm the YPG, Kurdish Popular Protection Units, which fight alongside the so-called opposition Syrian Democratic Forces. U.S. President Trump said the CIA would no longer arm the so-called moderate rebels battling the government of President Bashar al-Assad. And in early July, U.S. President Trump and Russian President Putin announced a ceasefire agreement for the southwest of the country, which is held as of early August. Ava Bartlett has returned to Syria for the seventh time to provide more coverage. An archive of her past and recent writings on Syria can be found on her website, ingaza.wordpress.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download our podcasts from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Music this week was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The show resumes next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.